I'm being thrust a piece of emergency paper now containing an up-to-the-minute news flash. We've just heard of yet another false nuclear alert among NATO forces in the Middle East. For a full 3.5 seconds yesterday morning, it was believed the world was at war. Releasing details of the incident, a Pentagon spokesman said the alarm was triggered by a numerical overload of a space invaders machine in the pilot's mess room. However, there was no danger. Repeat, however, there was no danger of any escalation, and the alert never got beyond computer stage. And certainly no nuclear bombers whatsoever got halfway to Russia and then had to turn back again. And now the rest of the news.
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. We call it that because we were on Bristol Community FM for 12 years here every week, studying politics, talking to funny little MPs, newbies like Darren Jones, talking about how he was going to get AI to do the police's job for it and make decisions about whether to charge people. Yeah, I remember him. He's now the chief spokesman for Sir Keir Starmer, the genocidalist prime minister. So that's what we used to do. We're not the BCFM politics show because we were hoofed off by Pat Hart, who was the station manager during COVID, because we were saying to people, beware of vaccines. Do not just simply accept this. And actually, anybody you talk to about this will admit it may have been a bit rushed, minimally. It may have been. Anyway, we're streaming live still from a corner of freedom close by Bristol city centre. Don't believe a word we say. But we do try, especially me, to share moments of clarity from Bristol's Templar Port, turned merchant venturer fiefdom in the city of London's Masonic UK Empire of Lies. If you've not heard about the merchant venturers, have a look. Medieval institution owns Bristol, owns much of the infrastructure that Margaret Thatcher privatised. Funny lot, actually. Not allowed to know anything about them either. So we're live on the talkradio.org.uk stream, DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. Available free from APK Pure or Apple App Store, but not the evil Google Play. Easiest place to get it is via the show page at thisweek.org.uk, and then go to the link to GitHub, and you can get all the different versions and up-to-date versions. In fact, there is a little bit of updating going on by Nick. He tells me to make it, because last week we had a few problems, as you might have noticed, anyone regular listeners. Radio 4 All was not accepting uploads at all. There's some miraculous amazement. One, the actual show itself got uploaded, but then nothing else was working. Radio 4 All has been down for much of the week. But it's back up again now, thank God. Well done, the hippies in California that run it, the ex-hippies, that used to work for something called Pacifica Radio. And so we finally got through to them, then it's all back and up, as of yesterday, up and running again. But that, of course, affected the app. So well done. And if there's ever any problem with anything, just go to the thisweek.org.uk, and there were some alternative downlinks up there pretty swiftly last Friday evening. Anyway, thanks for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with accelerationist, zero trust agenda psyops, bending our minds with Orwellian BBC Verify, or boring us to tears with vacuous celebrities. Puff pieces on the conspirators, hatchet jobs on the heroes as the Fourth Reich marches in, led by all these World Economic Forum. And Harry Fink now. Oh, Mr. BlackRock, World Economic Forum. All right, OK. You and Klaus Schwab, what a lovely pair you are. Martin Summers, Irish Republican Labour activist, is with me as we look at Netanyahu, the king of chaos, rolling out a blood red carpet for the Zionist man god Antichrist to come. But it's not the end of the world, or is it? Helping us navigate this Fourth Reich's Irish Republican Labour activist, as I say, Martin Summers. A couple of guests this week. We've got Madda London on, talking about her friend Tom Palmer. And if you look him up, you'll see some interesting articles about his demise. He was a London activist running a campaign against MI5, and suddenly they found him dead. Oh, straight strange, gone. So it's all a bit of a mystery. There was an inquest. Madda explains she was with him the night before he died. So that's one. We've also got Andy Gordon from New Zealand, from Dunedin, talking about this strange phenomenon of the Christian Zionist Maoris who were over to celebrate Tommy Robinson's so-called free speech, while a whole load of other activists who weren't so pro-Israel were stopped from speaking at the free speech rally. Hey, can anyone see through this Tommy Robinson stuff? Iranian and Russian news censored in the UK by the telecoms cartel and then Ofcom, but not on here. Us cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia and from PRSC by the trans lobby, but not cancelled from here yet. Biggest story this week, Martin, by far, was going to be the flotilla, wasn't it? About 500 activists and parliamentarians from all over the world sailing with a bit of aid for Gaza across the Mediterranean. In about 50 boats, 45 to 50 boats, and suddenly it's all knocked off the headlines.
Well, it's knocked off the headlines here in this country.
I mean, that is to say the Israeli raid on all these boats and the arrest of all these people.
Yes, okay, but I mean, in Italy, for example, there's been a general strike today because of the raid by the... And it's been supported by the CGIL, which is the mainstream trade unions. We couldn't... Because they can still have general strikes in Italy. Of course, we can't do those kind of things because we live in the free United Kingdom where
we could have a general strike if the TUC ordered one.
No, we couldn't.
Organise one.
No, the TUC would then be prosecuted in the courts and all of its assets would be seized.
Well, have to make a few arrangements for that first, wouldn't they? They can manage that.
No, it's not as easy as you think,
Tony. It is. It's much, much easier than you think. You think it's impossible. It's not impossible. The TUC could order such a thing, and then they could maybe, for example, resign from their posts beforehand.
Do you really want to discuss this, about whether we're having a general strike?
I think you could. We're not going to have
one,
but we could have
one. Are you a member of the NUJ? The NUJ isn't in the TUC, is it?
Does it matter? You see, you're just diverting, as you often do. I'm saying if the TUC really wanted to have a general strike, they could call one. They probably wouldn't get many people out, but they could do. And on all this idea about the legal reasons are a farce.
No.
Yes, they are.
It would be illegal, and this is...
The TUC would have its assets seized, right?
And all the unions...
Maybe they could move those assets beforehand.
Where would you move them to, Tony?
Somewhere else. Anywhere.
All right. At one stage during the miners' strike, the money of the NUM was put in, it was actually in boxes, okay? And the police seized it. Did they win that strike? It went on for nearly a year.
They were a bit stupid to let the police know where it was, weren't they?
Well, there you are. So maybe we don't need trade unions, Tony. What we need is probably armed organisations.
Oh, God. What? To do a general strike? Because we're not allowed to do a general strike, so Martin wants to have an armed uprising. This isn't very responsible, is it?
Well, all right. Well, I'm just telling you, in Italy, general strikes are not illegal.
Are you in a trade union?
Yes, I am. I'm in two, actually.
Ooh, that's a bit naughty.
All right.
But anyway, you're calling for, rather than votes through the TUC and organised general strike in Britain, you have to have an armed uprising instead.
No, I'm just saying you can't. In other countries in Europe, general strikes are legal. They're not legal in this country because we've had a Tory government which never got 50% of
the
vote.
We've got a Labour government. Why don't they just say, yes, we will have them again?
Well, because the Labour government is in the pocket of the wrong people, isn't it, Tony, as we all know? Okay. In actual fact, the strikes in Italy and originally were organised by base unions, not by the mainstream unions.
Oh, yes, that's exactly another thing that often happens, is a trade union has a kind of official and an unofficial arm. Anyway, we're here to talk about what's been going on in Gaza, but, I mean, I think before we hear from Richie Allen, because he did, I thought, an excellent... I was tweeting that Richie is in Manchester. Have a listen to him to get the latest on yesterday's news about the attack on the synagogue in Manchester yesterday morning. And but actually, the timing of it is extraordinary, isn't it? So if you look at the way that PSYOPs work, the purpose of them is to knock a specific type of story off the headline and to replace it with another one. So a very anti-Israel story, particularly specifically around this idea of the Israelis arresting all these international people trying to bring aid to Gaza, is knocked off the headlines by this event in Manchester. Now, you and I know that there is such a thing as MKUltra, and it is possible to either program, hypnotise, persuade people, particularly people with mental illness, to go and do these sorts of things. Now, the thing I find so extraordinary about this is how gung-ho the Manchester police are, so it's important that they are there to stop him. But not only that, they put a second bullet into him to make sure he was dead, even though he didn't actually have a bomb on him. We'll hear in a minute the police calling out that he did have a bomb, but that was a lie. And I suppose more importantly, the fact that they, on the news yesterday, they were saying that he had killed two people two worshippers at the synagogue, but actually he hadn't. The police had actually caused more casualties than he did. Now, I realise that these are a bit difficult to control, these sorts of events, but the news was totally the opposite of what was happening. Moans to the casualties were caused by these coppers with their guns, not by the guy with the knives.
Well, obviously, it's only recently happened, and facts are gradually being established about this. I take your point about the timing.
Well, hang on, because the police and the synagogue would have known that one of their own people had been shot dead by the police yesterday, wouldn't they? But they didn't tell anybody.
We know now, because they couldn't really
hide
it.
They're holding it back, because they know that the first day and the first coverage from a news story is what everyone remembers.
Yes. It's clearly. I mean, the Manchester police clearly messed up here. I think they've actually said we messed up here. So there you are. You're not supposed to shoot the worshippers, and probably they shouldn't have shot him either because he was not armed. But obviously that was a bit
more
problematic.
Well, he was armed with knives. They brought him to the ground. I don't know if you've seen the footage, and I won't share it actually, but you don't need to see it to know what happened. The guy's lying on the ground with, it looks like, maybe some knives by the side of him. He's obviously being shot. He's writhing around a bit, and he's moving slightly. And just as he, it looks like, makes an attempt to see, can I still get up, he's then shot dead. So the police are shouting, no, he's got a bomb. But he didn't have a bomb. We've just heard that, I think it's this morning. No bomb. There wasn't. He didn't have a suicide vest at all.
No, but if you could argue, I'm playing devil's advocate here, they did not know whether it was real or not. They can't presume, they've got to presume
well,
that it might
be. Why don't they stand away from the guy if they think he's about to blow himself up? Why'd they stand right next to him?
Because I don't know. They will have to justify this. There will no doubt be an inquiry, and no doubt they'll have to justify what they did and didn't do. I don't know. I wasn't there. I'm listening to what you're saying. Everybody's finding out the facts about what happened, aren't they?
Yeah. So anyway, let's kick off by listening to 6 or 7 minutes of the Richie Allen show from yesterday, where Richie talks us through it. Now, I think for our podcast, we might have to bleep some of the swear words. But anyway, Richie goes for it here. And we hear also some clips from Keir Starmer's statement about the attack, and also from Julia Hartley Brewer on the Murdoch Zionist Network.
The crimes against humanity committed by the Israelis in Gaza are unspeakable. The videos I've seen online of children, unrecognisable, and their mothers and their aunts weeping and screaming and wailing while the bombs are still dropping around them. And the inversion is, you talk about how those who are responsible for it are being dehumanised. Of course, British Jews have no responsibility whatsoever for what's happening in Gaza. Let me say it again. They are overwhelmingly against it. Have they lost their memories? Who remembers a year and a half ago a major train station in London being taken over by Jewish Londoners to say, not in our name, stop the genocide? But again, those are the wrong Jews. I'm going to play a couple more clips. This is particularly egregious. This is Julia Hartley Brewer, who was taken by the hand by the Israelis recently and given a lovely luxury trip to downtown Tel Aviv. And, well, she earned it today. This is Brewer. She puts the blame squarely at the feet of Keir Starmer for the attack in Crumpsall this morning.
Prime Minister, I don't think you have done enough to keep our Jewish community safe. I think when you happily allow these pro-Palestinian marchers on the streets, and yeah, the last government did too. I think it was a point when they
What do you mean you happily allow the pro-Palestine marchers? You hypocritical C-nut. You bang on about loss of freedoms on talk radio. You bang on about free speech when it suits you. You bang on about poor old Lucy Connolly, the stupid Izzy Bint, who incited basically arson against a migrant hotel. Now, I didn't think a custodial sentence was warranted there. I said that a proper smack on the wrist and a big fine would have shut Lucy Connolly up. But oh, free speech, they're so typical. The only speech they want to preserve is their own. This cow is screaming and ranting about the fact that people were allowed. How dare they be allowed to go out on the streets to say, stop murdering children in Gaza? How dare you allow it? because one or two Jews might be upset. Well, if one or two Jews are upset about people marching to stop the murder of children, f*** them in the ear. F*** off back to your house and don't listen to it. It gets worse, this... I've never used that word that ends with stunt on any radio show ever. I've used it privately and I've used it online when I've posted. I used it today, but it's a word I've never used here. Listen to this.
Supportive of the Palestinian people and people in Gaza. They're just pro-Hamas marchers. A lot of the people...
Oh, yeah, yeah. Listen to this. I mean, this is positively libelous stuff, this, but she's clever enough not to mention any names.
They were supportive of the Palestinian people and people...
Yes, the marches were to support the Palestinian people.
...in Gaza. They're just pro-Hamas marchers. A lot of the people who organise them are very, very closely linked with the Hamas terrorists.
Give me an example. I want an example right now. I want a name. I want a name. Name me somebody involved in arranging a pro-Palestine march who is on the payroll of Hamas. Name one. Name one. But of course, you wouldn't name one. I emailed them this morning. Of course, I got no response. Ask your grotesquely stupid presenter to name somebody who organised a Palestine march who had a connection to Hamas. No chance.
Who launched the attack on October the 7th and still hold hostages right now, starved and beaten and tortured in tunnels under Gaza City and elsewhere. When so little's done, when pro-Palestinian activists are able to, you know, freely basically set off fireworks and act with impunity on our streets.
What the f***? Set off fireworks? Pro-Palestinian activists? They're allowed to do it freely? And there's something wrong with this, is there? Is there?
As they did in London only last night. If you look at my social media, you see I've just retweeted some images of that. Not a police officer in sight.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And she blames Starmer.
It's too late. It's too late, Prime Minister. And when you recognise a Palestinian state, the cause that has been used to justify so much of the, not anti-Zionism, not pro-Palestinian, not anti-Israel, but anti-Semitic views and opinions and attacks on our streets... You gave them succour. You basically said, carry on, we'll give you the reward. That's what you did. This is on you.
Starmer's wife is Jewish, and her family are in Israel. Now, it's not going to happen, because they're all playing for the same team. I know some people find it difficult to believe this, but Starmer, Badenoch, Farage, the media, they're all on the same team. So Starmer won't sue. Well, he won't. Sue, he probably wouldn't succeed in suing, but he's got a regulatory grievance there. He could go to Ofcom and talk radio could be fined an enormous amount of money. Starmer had nothing to do with whatever happened in Crumpsall this morning. This really is, as I said earlier, grotesque. It is dressed up as news.
You. This is on you, Prime Minister, so don't you dare say we'll put police outside synagogues. You're one of the reasons why there need to be police outside synagogues. Don't you
imagine that you're the reason or one of them why police need to be outside synagogues. Back to what I was saying earlier on about the media and how it operates. You know, once you see it, you can't unsee it. You know, the Prime Minister is leaving a meeting in Denmark to arrive back in London to chair a Cobra meeting. Kate is outside Downing Street. Hi, Kate. Any sign of the Prime Minister? And a breathless Kate is staring down the lens. No, Mary. Not yet, no. Oh, here's the convoy now. In pulls a motorcade of three cars. Out gets Starmer. And then you have morons working for the BBC and Sky shouting at him, are Jews safe, Prime Minister? Are Jews safe? This is theatre, spectacle. It isn't news. And the King and Queen send their condolences. And then the Prince and Princess of Wales, of course, had to put out an official statement as if it wasn't bad enough. We had to hear from the King and the so-called Queen. It's madness, this. Madness. I swear to your comments after I have a drink of water and take a deep breath. That's right, Jay. Oh. This song was written about a German shepherd that grows up in Salford. If you believe that, you'll believe Julia Hartley Brewer. Actually, I'm going to kill that now, and I'm going to take you to a live feed of Keir Starmer talking in Downing Street. See what sort of Starmer's coming out with.
We provide refuge. We provide a home. For so many Jewish families, that is the story of Britain. But Britain is also a country where Jewish buildings, synagogues, even schools require round-the-clock protection, where dedicated specialist security is necessary.
Yeah, it's a protection racket. I'm sorry for interjecting. I have to say this. The Community Securities Trust is the mafia. It runs a protection racket against Jewish citizens by convincing them their very existence is under threat constantly. And it f***ing isn't. What do you think it does to those children in those schools? Drills. Why? Why drills? For what? Schools, has never been an attack on a Jewish kindergarten or a Jewish school. Ever. I'm not saying that every now and then some drunk kid or some guy with genuine anti-Jewish feelings might not put some graffiti on a wall. It happens. But they terrorise Jewish children. They used to do it exclusively in Israel. Now they do it around the world. You're the chosen ones, and everybody wants to kill you, and it isn't true. The CST runs a protection racket, and it is incredibly lucrative. The cheek of Starmer to insinuate that Jews have, as I said, you know, reason to fear for their lives in this, the most tolerant country on planet Earth.
Because of the daily threat of anti-Semitic hatred, today's horrific incident shows why. And while this is not a new hate, this is something Jews have always lived with, we must be clear. It is a hatred that is rising once again.
No, it isn't.
And Britain must defeat it once again.
No, it isn't. If by hatred you mean how British people feel sick to their very souls at what is going on the other side of the Mediterranean. Is that what you mean by hatred? People exercising their human right, the right they were given when they were born, to have an opinion, whether you like it or hate it. That isn't threatening anybody. But that's what they mean, you see. They're making hay while the sun shines on the back of this attack. And that will lead people, justifiably, to wonder if we're really being told everything there is to be told about the attack and where it came from.
On behalf of the nation, I want to offer my condolences to the families and victims affected. I want to thank the Greater Manchester Police, the first responders, and those dedicated security specialists. There is no doubt whatsoever that they have prevented an even greater tragedy, and we thank them for their bravery. But to every Jewish person in this country, I also want to say this. I know how much fear you will be holding inside of you. I really do.
And there will be Jewish people screaming at the television, "You don't speak for me. I don't have any fear inside of me at all. I know exactly what game you are playing, and I ain't participating," as there will be many Jews saying this this evening.
And so, on behalf of our country, I express my solidarity, but also my sadness, that you still have to live with these fears.
Right. I won't subject you to any more of it. I said we'd read the comments as they come. Tony Gosling has been in touch. "Be afraid, Richie. Red paint attack on London Jewish school last year." Yeah, that's it, Tony, isn't it? That is it in a nutshell. Stamford Hill. Somebody threw paint on a wall.
Martin, it's nice that Richie used my comment there to illustrate that this whole idea that anti-Semitism is a terrible, massive scourge. It's almost back to the days of Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party. Is it a scourge in Britain?
Well, I wouldn't say that there isn't some anti-Semitism, largely on the right wing of British politics. You will find some people in the golf clubs who really still don't like Jews, but it's not actually a major issue. And of course, what happened in Australia, where they got rid of the Iranian diplomatic corps from Australia because apparently, according to the Secret Services, there were two Jewish businesses. One was a synagogue and one was a restaurant, and somebody had thrown paint on them, as you were saying about the school having, and a lot of these things, and of course it's certainly been the case in other parts of the world, is that these are actually confected. You know, this has happened in the US where people said somebody put sprayed a swastika on my door in the college, and it turned out it's the woman herself who sprayed the swastika on the door. It's a standard tactic adopted by Zionist activists all over the world, where they in fact spray up their own anti-Jewish slogans, and then they say, oh, look, somebody's having a go at us. It's quite deliberate.
I remember Anton Chaikin talking about Zionist groups in the United States who were openly saying, we need to launch attacks on synagogues in the United States and blame it on Arabs.
That's right. That's right. They've been doing it for years, and there's plenty of evidence. People say, you can't say that. I say, there is the internet. Go and look. Now, what happened in Australia is that the Labour government, the Albanese government, the police had investigated one of these incidents and concluded that it was indeed a complete fraud. Yeah. So, in other words, it's quite easy, if you are a Zionist activist, to go out and do things against the Jewish community, like vandalising shops or synagogues, and then try and put the blame on others. And it's a standard procedure. They've been doing it for years. The Israeli state, in fact, massacred loads of Iraqi Jews in the 1950s. Well, they bombed synagogues, and then they said, oh, you'll have to come to Israel, otherwise you're going to die. But it was actually them who bombed the synagogues.
Well, there were all sorts of questions about the bombing of the Israeli embassy in Buenos Aires in the 1990s. I remember
the Israeli embassy. It was a community centre.
An Israeli community centre. There's all sorts of questions about that. When the government started initially, they said, oh, this is obviously some sort of Palestine Liberation Organisation / Islamic jihadi attack.
Hezbollah were blamed.
You're right, actually. Yeah, sorry about that. The Lebanese lot. Then the next government, I can't remember the name of the president or prime minister, but they started investigating and found actually there's lots of clues here that this was a false flag attack here in Buenos Aires, and he promptly died in a helicopter crash.
Yeah, people can look up all of this stuff. I mean, you've got to ask yourself a simple question. Why would Hezbollah from Lebanon want to attack a Jewish community centre in Buenos Aires? And the answer is they wouldn't. There's no reason for them to do that whatsoever.
PSYOP, maybe?
Well, Hezbollah, in fact, has never attacked anything outside Lebanon, as far as I know. But, of course, they're presented as... Hezbollah and Hamas are both illegal organisations in this country. They were made illegal by the Tory government not that long ago. But, of course, they are both political parties. Hamas was the biggest political party in Palestine in 2006. They won the election, but it was stolen from them. Hezbollah is not the biggest political... It is the biggest political party in Lebanon, but, of course, they've got a splintered political structure there. So these are actually political movements.
Hezbollah are being smashed to bits in Lebanon, by the way.
They haven't been completely smashed to bits.
Well, they are being smashed. I'm saying in the process of being smashed to bits. The idea is push them out of the government, push them out of the armed forces, all this sort of thing, so that the Lebanese army, which are more pro-Israeli than Hezbollah, and so this is just a classic divide and rule tactic. Anyway, look, back to yesterday in Manchester, because we have just been discussing, before we heard from Richie Allen, because it wasn't known back then, who died and how. And so we first of all had one of the worshippers attacked with this nutter with knives, and it looks like he died on the scene. Then the police turned up very, very rapidly and shot the attacker with brandishing his knives. They didn't shoot him dead, but then as they were shooting at him, they were shooting... The other side of him was the doors of the synagogue. And on the other side of the doors of the synagogue were various worshippers who were making sure that they were securing the building so that Mr. Nutcase couldn't get in there. Now, as the police were shooting at the attacker, alleged attacker, I suppose we should call him, there were two people inside the synagogue who were badly injured. One of them has since died. So there were two deaths out on the scene. And obviously the police knew this, maybe not reporters, but certainly the synagogue knew this, what had happened. You got one, dead. Actually, you've got two dead worshippers. One killed by the police. One killed by the attacker. And then you've got the attacker himself being finished off by the police, where they say he's got a bomb, but he didn't have a bomb. So they just got that wrong. So anyway, let's have a listen now to how it was reported yesterday. This is at 6 o'clock. So this is 7 or 8 hours after this happened. And so, how did the BBC report it? Let's have a listen.
Anybody else? Get back! If you're not involved, move back! Get away! Somebody's stealing the casualties! Everybody else! He has a ball! Go away!
The moments before armed police shot a knifeman who'd attacked a synagogue in Manchester, killing two people.
Right, so that's how the BBC reports it. He attacked a synagogue, killing two people, apparently. Only that was 8 hours pretty much after the attack, but they got that completely wrong. So as I was saying, and of course he got the police saying he's got a bomb. Get away, move away. He didn't have a bomb. So much of that first initial soundbite is just nonsense. And it's, I mean, you could put some of this down to, oh well, it was all in the heat of events, but the police knew what had happened. They didn't know at that time, when the guy was shouting, obviously, that it wasn't a real bomb that he had. It was some sort of pretend bomb. But they certainly knew that that one of the both police and the people in the synagogue, and surely the BBC knew that one of the victims was not a victim of the attacker, as they stated there at 6 p.m. Was actually a victim of the police. But of course, it all the headlines that go around the world have that yesterday, have that soundbite. They have to clear this up afterwards in news bulletins and news stories that don't get anywhere near as much providence as it did yesterday.
No, well, obviously this is still a developing story, but we know a lot more, for example, about what happened at the Manchester Arena bombing some years ago. And it's quite clear that Salman Abedi, who was supposedly the bomber, was in fact a member of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, and he'd been fighting in Libya under the direction of MI6 literally the week before he turned up in Manchester. Because the headquarters of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group are indeed in Manchester. They were put in Manchester as the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group in the 1980s, and lots of Libyans were then trained by British Special Forces to fight in Afghanistan, and then they were infiltrated back into Libya to overthrow Gaddafi. So the very least you could say about the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group with its headquarters in Manchester is that that was blowback on MI6's intervention in Afghanistan and Libya, and of course in Syria, where we now have al-Jilani, who was the head of al-Qaeda and ISIS in Syria, who's on the British payroll. Yeah. Now, how many people in the BBC and their unit that checks all these facts and figures is going to point out to the British people that Al-Qaeda was created by our security forces, by MI6. They even thought of the name.
The so-called Manchester bomber was working for the Foreign Office the week before.
He was working for our intelligence services and military. And his father...
MI6 is the Foreign Office, isn't it?
Well, MI6 is MI6, okay? The point is that he was actually... and his father then came up in Libya and said this was a fix by MI6, and then he disappeared.
Well, what about the possibility of a PSYOP here? So,
before
we started, you were talking a bit about Sirhan Sirhan. I mean, we know now that that was a PSYOP, that he didn't actually kill RFK, he was there, he had a gun, he possibly even fired the gun, but the actual execution was done by somebody else who slipped away. But Sirhan Sirhan is still in jail, and he was a Palestinian. The idea was to blame it on the Palestinians, and many people say actually it was the mafia, the Israeli mafia.
Mafia, you're not wrong, because Meyer Lansky, who used to head up the mafia in the US, he was Jewish and very pro-Israel, as are many mafia people in the US. So, and of course, the Mossad have been working very heavily with the mafia for years. That's, you know, Jack Ruby was a Jewish gangster.
I mean, is it possible to persuade somebody to go and do an attack like this at a specific time? Is that feasible?
We know it's possible.
How?
Because it's they've been trained. People need to look up MK Ultra, which was a CIA program begun in the 1940s and 1950s, which was trying to program people You know, they were desperately trying to see, can we brainwash people to do stuff like this? And if the answer is yes. You've got to have the subject you choose has got to be suitable, yeah? And often people with mental health issues end up being
it's people who are very depressed, and they're then fed with antidepressant drugs. So they get extremely nasty, as we know, with various people who've been loose on the streets stabbing people, who are supposed to be in the care of social services or the security services, but have kind of... gone rogue. So it is feasible, but so it's almost like a psychological thing where there are all sorts of pressures piled on you, and you're looking for an outlet for your anger. You're sent to a certain place in a certain direction, and out your anger comes.
Yes, and don't forget that as the Russian general staff and the Iranian general staff well know, much of the jihadi networks, which are supposedly the enemies of the West, are in fact puppets of the West.
Well, I mean,
Saudi Arabia is the heartland of Islamic extremism. When the Tories and the Liberal Party were in power, they had an investigation into who was pushing extremist jihadi propaganda in Britain. And guess what? That report said it was the Saudi-funded mosques. And that report was then repressed, and we weren't allowed to read it. Because, of course, the Saudi Mukhabarat and MI6 created Al-Qaeda in the first place. And, of course, we could say, well, that was years ago. But in actual fact, Al-Jilani, who came to this country not long ago, used to be the head of ISIS and Al-Qaeda in Syria, killed loads of people. They're still killing loads of people. But he's our best mate.
Anyway, for me, the big thing is the timing, because this has completely swamped the news all day yesterday, when otherwise everyone would have been talking in this country about the Greta Thunberg and the Gaza aid flotilla, which was being attacked by the Israeli Defence Forces. Everyone impounded, ships arrested and everything. Well, sorry, people arrested, ships impounded. This would have been all over the news otherwise, because, of course, actually they've made quite a lot of effort to make sure that these things were able to be live-streamed. Instead, the news is talking about something completely different. In fact, the opposite, upside-down version of that story. Oh, dear, the poor Zionists. Oh, dear, the poor Israelis. They are the victims, whereas, actually, they're the perpetrators. They're the genocide. And so are the Western media, the London media. They're aiding this genocide, as we'll hear some more from in a little while. But the timing is extraordinary, isn't it? Because that to me, is like the dig giveaway, right? It's just happened right at the right time to turn that story upside down.
Yes, it has. And if you were a jihadi, I suppose you might genuine jihadi, you might choose that moment to make your strike. But of course, it's totally unhelpful. It does nothing to advance the cause of Palestine. His father... The father of the guy who's been shot, the saying how appalled he was and how disgusted he was with what his son had done. But of course, his son, quite possibly, as we will find out in due course, could easily be one of these people who's been got at and pushed in the direction, the way you're suggesting.
We may find out, because of course, dead men tell no tales. Isn't it handy when someone is shot dead? No trial. Well, the inquest's going to take a long, long time, and we have loads and loads of experts, but we've already decided why he did it, and it's because he was a naughty bad jihadi. He's probably a lone nutter, even and definitely not known to MI5, of course.
Now, coming back to the Manchester Arena bombing, the timing of that was also important, because, of course, Jeremy Corbyn was about to go into a general election campaign, and what they hoped...
Well, he was already in the campaign,
And what they hoped that would be the result of that is it would cause a reaction against Corbyn. But Corbyn, in fact, played a straight bat and said, these things are happening because we've taken war to other people's countries. They shouldn't be happening, but but people got the point. And the same thing happened in 2004, 2005 with the Madrid train bombings, which all carry out in the middle of an election campaign.
Was that in Spain? The election was in Spain, was it?
Spain, yes. Yeah. And strangely enough, all of these three train bombings were in the socialist voting suburbs around Madrid. So what they hoped was this would keep Aznar in power, the right wing in power, who supported the invasion of Iraq. In actual fact, that didn't happen. 1.5 million people came out to vote who didn't normally vote, the poor and the young, and they kicked Aznar out.
So
and Zapatero, the socialist, won.
Spain and with Corbyn, who was fixing those elections then by terrorist attacks?
The deep state, in my view, the NATO Gladio infrastructure was trying to fix both elections by using terrorism. These people are terrorists. If we can prove that MI6 was behind this attack, we can turn this against them, because in actual fact, all of the horror about killing innocent people at their synagogue, maybe you're the guilty parties. Maybe you're running all of this. Yeah, just like in Buenos Aires, it looks like Mossad bombed that Jewish community centre. Because that's the thing is, people can't get their heads around how evil Zionism is. Zionists, when they first set up the state in the 1940s, they killed loads of Jewish people who didn't agree with what was going on. They killed loads of Palestinians, they killed loads of British soldiers, they killed loads of British police officers, they killed Lord Moyne, they killed Count Bernadotte, the UN envoy.
They even planned to kill Winston Churchill.
Yes, they tried to kill Churchill and Bevin. And they're not terrorists, you see, Tony. Yeah, they're just the good guys. Yeah. They've always been the good guys.
They're just the IDF.
Yeah.
And the Mossad's slogan is, by deception shall we do war. I think, isn't it, False Flag was the book by Viktor Ostrovsky, which anyone that wants to get a little bit of an insight into what really goes on inside the Mossad, read Ostrovsky. Absolutely brilliant, best-selling book. Now, you mentioned Operation Gladio there. What do you mean by Operation Gladio?
Well, the Gladio infrastructure was created from the 1940s onwards. Anybody can do a search online and you will see what it comes up. Gladio is the name of a sword. It's the Roman name for a sword, a Roman sword. And what it is, it was supposedly a stay-behind structure in case the Soviets ever invaded Western Europe, and they would organise a sort of a guerrilla army to resist them. But in actual fact, what it became is a secret state within the state to prevent, for example, the Communist Party, Partito Comunista Italiano, the Italian Communist Party, from getting any share of power in Italy.
Nope.
So they bomb Bologna railway station, and we know all of this because there's a book written by the head of the Italian Supreme Court, Fernando Imposimato, which came out in 2012, La Repubblica dei Stragi Impuni, The Republic of the Unpunished Massacres. And it's based on years and years and years of investigation by real civilian police officers into the NATO infrastructure. And it's quite clear that NATO, MI6, is a terrorist organisation. Nobody in West Belfast will be surprised when I say that.
Well, this is all over. The amazing thing is, in the 1990s, this documentary was done by the BBC. We didn't really know very much about this when we were doing the 9/11 Truth campaign around about 2003.
I'd seen it.
You had seen it at the time. And I know, but we were saying to each other, I remember very, very well, saying, where is this series? It's not on the internet. Where is it? So we put out an appeal. Can anybody dig out these three episodes of Time Watch from 1992 or 93, Operation Gladio? And someone did. I think it was in the Falmouth Art College video library, and they digitised it, put it online. So we were all able to watch it in 2004 and ever since. But it was a bit crackly, wasn't it?
If you go and try and find it, it's a bit by Frankovich. It's on the internet. It's lots of people.
But anyway,
BBC themselves have got an archive of it, but they've never.
Well, this is what I'm coming to is, just over the last month or so, somebody has got a really nice top quality, high quality, high definition version of Alan Frankovich's brilliant three-part documentary about NATO blowing up Europe and trying to blame it on the Soviet Union at the time, called Operation Gladio, part of Time Watch. And so let's have a little clip from one of the episodes of that now, a little bit crisper than we've ever heard it before. I'll put obviously a link up to these new high definition-ish versions of Operation Gladio by Alan Frankovich on tonight's show page.
For 40 years, secret terrorist organizations, many trained by Western intelligence agencies, have manipulated the political control of European sovereign states by a campaign of terror and murder. Originally part of a secret network, these groups changed from being defenders of state security into attackers of the established political order. Until 2 years ago, that secret network was generally known by the single word, Gladio. On November the 9th, 1990, the Prime Minister of Italy, Giulio Andreotti, revealed to his own parliament and the world the existence of a top-secret European-wide network of secret agents. It was called Gladio. This network of stay-behind groups was intended to fight a Soviet invasion of Western Europe. Andreotti's announcement led to an immediate reaction in the capitals of Europe. The suspicion was that some parts of the Gladio structures were involved in internal subversion.
Within NATO itself, There was no coordinating responsibility for Gladio. However, superimposed over NATO, there was a coordinating office in something called ITAC, which was nominally in the Defense Department, Intelligence Tactical Assessment Center, in which there were, among other things, a NATO desk. That NATO desk was owned by the agency. Although it was nominally with the Defense Intelligence Agency, it was staffed traditionally by the CIA.
Secret Service documents from several member countries reveal Gladio to be a European-wide organization, including Denmark, Norway, Holland, Spain, Turkey, and Greece. All Gladio's secret information is coordinated in Brussels through the CPC, Clandestine Planning Committee, which meets periodically, with the chairmanship being handed from one country's secret service to the next. The entire organization is handled outside of NATO.
I was once in charge of Low Country affairs, and I know how the Dutch and the Belgians and the Luxembourgeois felt about Stay Behind, and how very carefully they handled it, and how extremely secret it was. I know when I was chief in the Low Countries, the chief of service didn't want to discuss it in his office. We'd walk in the park and talk about burials that were being put down, communication equipment, or whether or not the latest equipment they had, and so forth.
There were people inside the American government, George Kennan most notably, who were arguing that the chance of the Communist Party winning the 1948 elections was so great that the United States should use military force to stop the elections, not hold the elections at all, just cancel the elections, send the army in and say to the communists, we're not going to risk elections because there's a chance of your winning. Well, this was laughed out of school by the president and the secretary of state and all other responsible government officials. I mean, none of that was ever put into effect. And the United States said, okay, well, we'll run the elections and we'll compete in the elections.
General Marshall and James Forrestal and Alan Dulles all realized that in 1948, it was an absolutely critical moment, and that the United States didn't have, they had an intelligence service, which was quite new and young. It could collect intelligence, it could have counterintelligence, it could do everything, but it could not carry out a covert operation. There was no charter for it. And so that was remedied quite rapidly.
There was no need for Gladio to be activated in Italy in 1948. The CIA's first major covert operation succeeded without it. Large sums of money to political parties helped the Christian Democrats defeat Palmiro Togliatti and the communists. Earlier, there had been an attempt on Togliatti's life. It's never been discovered who was behind this, but the Italian press declared that it was the work of a madman.
Yeah, so there you go. That's one of the opening parts of the first of the Gladio documentaries, now available in nice, easy to watch, easy to see, clear screens rather than slightly, faded ones that have been around for the last 20 years, actually, of that film, if anyone wants to watch it. But I didn't even mention the kidnapping and murder of the Italian Prime Minister Aldo Moro in there. So this is quite a dangerous organisation. Certainly it's opposed to democratic politics. And when he's talking about the 1948 elections in Italy being a critical moment, you could say the same about the 2017 elections in the UK when Jeremy Corbyn nearly won.
You could. And of course, the fact is that there's historically the case that both the Israeli state and the Western European states and the United States have been involved in covert terrorism for years. And the other obvious point to make is nobody disputes that Al-Qaeda was originally created by MI6 and the CIA and the DGSE in France to fight in Afghanistan against the Soviet Union. And they were even, there were plenty of people were saying at the time, there's a film, a Hollywood film, Charlie Wilson's War, which is all, it just has Tom Hanks as Charlie Wilson, Senator Charlie Wilson, and it's all about how they secretly funded all of these jihadis inside Afghanistan, brought them in from all over the world, provided them with loads of weaponry, and it was all done secretly, partly through funded through the sale of heroin in Western and Europe and in the United States, just as terrorists in Nicaragua were fighting the Democratic government of Nicaragua, they were funded with crack cocaine, which was also being trucked into the United States. We've got the evidence for all of this stuff is already there. We don't really know exactly what happened yesterday, but we've got all of this evidence that both the Israeli state, the British state, and the American state have been involved in terrorism, specifically jihadi terrorism, for years. Now, it used to be just people like us on little shows like this saying these things, but I bet you a pound to a ruble that the Russian general staff are very well aware of all of these things.
So
of course they are.
Obviously, there is this massacre going on in Gaza. The Israelis consider this a war. They want to pursue it by whatever means. Viktor Ostrovsky's book, as I mentioned, is by way of deception. So actually, the Israelis are admitting quite openly that their secret services there abroad to deceive. And so maybe that's what happened yesterday, a bit of deception going on.
Well, indeed. I mean, there's a book, Rise Up and Kill First, which is, based on, it's a sort of limited hangout of what they get up to. Because, of course, they quite like the idea that everybody should be frightened of them. But you don't really have to. The assassination of Nasrallah, the assassination of the Hamas leadership in Iran, the attack on the Iranian military and scientific leadership, the Israelis go around killing people, even people that they're pretending to talk to. Yeah, they even boast about it. Now, as Caitlin Johnson, the Australian journalist, points out, when people say what they are, you should believe them. The Israelis boast that they do not care about any of those things. They're not interested in playing by any kind of international rules. So it's perfectly legitimate for us to say, well, maybe what happened yesterday, that was you. Now, I'm not saying we can prove it, but it's perfectly legitimate for us to raise that question.
Well, this is what irritates me,
isn't it?
Is the BBC are telling Porky Pie at 6 p.m. on their bulletin last night, they're certainly not putting any balance about the possibility that this is a false flag operation. They're not. That is just a silly conspiracy theory. Actually, no, it's balance. What you should be doing is saying, well, this is an interesting coincidence. And is it possible that maybe the police overreacted by killing the guy because there's no trial? These are all very important elements to what happened yesterday. And it seems to me now that the police actually are told, just blow them away, then we don't have to have a trial. Trials are complicated. Trials, you have to reveal things in trials.
Obviously, it wasn't as big a death toll as the Bologna bomb in 1980, but 7/7 in London killed 50-odd people, did it not? But, of course, Netanyahu had a warning. He was a finance minister from Israel. He was in London that day, and I think it was the Jerusalem Post or the Times of Israel phoned up the embassy.
Associated Press, actually. Jerusalem desk of Associated Press.
And they phoned up and said, oh, there's been a bomb attack. Is Bibi all right? And they said, yes, he's been all right. He's all right. He didn't go to his meeting today.
The guy that said it is Dan Shahan, by the way. He was the guy at the Israeli embassy that said this. Carry on.
Yes. And he said he didn't go because we had a warning. Now, how can you have a warning about a surprise attack? That, to me, is what Sherlock Holmes would call a clue about who actually did it.
They said they passed it on to Scotland Yard.
Scotland Yard denied that. And, of course, what you should have done at that point, if I was running Scotland Yard, if I was Mark Rowley — it wasn't Mark Rowley in those days, I can't remember who it was — is you seal off the Israeli embassy and you say, right, where did you get your warning from?
I'm not an authoritarian type of person, but if you remember Clockwork Orange, that film where he's forced to watch a film, where they get his eyelids and they force them open with, like, matchsticks, you've got to watch this film. I would like to get some senior people in the Western world to watch the Gladio series to force them. Well, look, I mean, they obviously don't want to know. It's kind of willful blindness. But everybody that cares for their friends, their loved ones, wants a decent future for our children, should watch that three-part series, because it gives you a really good education in what our governments and NATO specifically are prepared to do in order to get their way. And that means killing people like you and I in the street and then blaming it on whatever the enemy happens to be at the time.
Vincenzo Vinciguerra, who's one of the people who's interviewed for the film —
he's a brilliant interviewer.
He's a fascist. He was a fascist terrorist.
He was interviewed in prison, wasn't he?
Yes, he was a fascist terrorist, and he was saying, well, the state doesn't prosecute the state. Yeah, I mean, you don't. You need to realise that, you know, that we were part of the state. Mm. And of course, we call the Anni di Piombo, the years of lead in Italy, and it was, you know, left-wing terrorists supposedly assassinating police officers, right-wing terrorists who blew up Bologna Railway Station, Bologna's a communist boating town, all of this. And it turns out, in the end, all of it was being run by the secret services, as the police investigated and found out, and the head of the Supreme Court in Pozzimalto wrote a book about it just before he died. His brother was actually killed by the mafia, and British MEP for this area, Richard Cottrell, used to be a Tory MEP for this area. So he's written a book. He lives in Italy now, and it's called Gladio, the NATO fascist mafia dagger at the heart of Europe. And of course, we can add to that now the jihadi terrorists. Jihadi terrorism was the creature of the Saudi Mukhabarat, the MI6, CIA, DGSC, and all of jihadi terrorism, including in Syria, where it's quite obvious. The people in Iraq and Syria, ordinary people, are very well aware that these extreme jihadi Salafi terrorists are tools of Western and Israeli imperialism.
It sounds like a tangent we just went off on there from Manchester, but it isn't, is it? Because it's the context of everything that's been going on.
Because it's the context. That's why we're able to say, look, we're suspicious about this and we've got reason to be suspicious.
So
that's why we're mentioning the bombing of the Manchester Arena. The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group did that. Their headquarters are in Manchester because Margaret Thatcher gave them a headquarters in Manchester and we funded them, just as we've been funding Jalani in Syria. This guy was supposedly from Syria. Born in Syria, but brought up in this country. The Syrian head choppers are our allies, as everybody knows, in the rest of the world.
Well, look, let's go back to Manchester and just remind listeners of what we heard just now, which is the BBC reporting what happened at 6 p.m. yesterday, which is actually... first of all, we got the police saying he's got a bomb, which he didn't have. And secondly, the BBC newsreader saying that the attacker had actually killed two people when he hadn't. The police had killed one of them.
Somebody else! Get back! If you're not involved, move back! Get away! Somebody's still in touch with you! Everybody else! He has a bomb! Go away!
The moments before armed police shot a knifeman who'd attacked a synagogue in Manchester, killing two people.
No, he hadn't. And no, he didn't have a bomb. So the first one, yeah, he had something which looked like it could possibly be a suicide vest, even though the police were stood right near him, would probably have been very badly injured if he had blown himself up. So maybe they knew he didn't have one. I have no idea. But certainly complete rubbish when it came to the police actually killing someone. They didn't say that at all in there. But anyway, a little bit later in that bulletin, after lots and lots of shenanigans about Manchester, some other stories to do with Gaza and to do with the Israel-Palestine conflict popped up on our on that bulletin. And they were to do with the Gaza peace deal that Trump is supposed to be doing. Tony Blair apparently involved, and a whole bunch of billionaires. And the flotilla being raided by the Israelis. 500 or so parliamentarians heading to relieve the siege of Gaza. And also a fake protest. And that's another side, another interesting aspect of this. I saw this going around yesterday. It was a flyer for a protest to shut down railway stations. But actually, it had no, it was all sort of pixelated, almost looked like it was deliberately pixelated, so you could hardly read it. And you certainly couldn't see who'd done it. So I don't think anybody actually went. But this was, all it was a meme being circulated on social media. And of course, the British Transport Police picked up on it. But it's became part of the news yesterday. So let's have a listen to this part of the bulletin, which talks about these other aspects.
The BBC understands that the head of Hamas's military wing in Gaza has indicated he will not agree to President Trump's peace plan. Sources say that mediators have made contact with Izz al-Din al-Haddad, who believes the plan is designed to finish the organization and he's determined to fight on. Separately, hundreds of activists face deportation from Israel after the Israeli military intercepted their flotilla of boats trying to bring aid to Gaza. From Jerusalem, here's our correspondent John Sodworth.
On the ground in Gaza, international diplomacy seems remote. Dozens of people were brought to this hospital, some of them said to have been injured while seeking aid. And with no let-up in Israel's ground offensive in Gaza City, the remaining residents are still weighing the risks of staying against the risks of leaving. I'm afraid for my son. He's my only one, this woman says. There was shelling. All the residents from our building left, so we're leaving too. Despite US optimism about its peace plan, the prospects still seem highly uncertain. While Hamas's political leadership, based in Qatar, has reservations, reports suggest it's open to accepting the plan with amendments. But the proposals, which set a tight deadline for Hamas to release the remaining hostages, are far vaguer on the timetable for Israeli military withdrawal. And the BBC understands that the head of the organization's military wing in Gaza believes it's a trap and is likely to choose to keep fighting.
If you continue on your route and attempt to breach the naval blockade, we will stop your vessel and act to confiscate it through legal proceedings in court.
Separately, hundreds of activists detained after Israeli commandos intercepted their flotilla and stormed their boats have been brought to the Israeli port of Ashdod and are now being processed for deportation. Among them, the Swedish campaigner Greta Thunberg.
The British Transport Police have warned that protesters may attempt to target the railways this evening in response to Israel intercepting the flotilla. Officers said they were aware of information on social media suggesting there could be disruption. The police urged people not to take part in any protests, saying the railway was incredibly dangerous and anyone stepping onto the tracks could easily die or suffer serious injury.
Right, well, not so much in Scotland because there's not much electrification up there. But anyway, the point is, I'm sure if the police have got any intelligence, British Transport Police, they can see that this is bogus. They could even call up Palestine Solidarity groups around the country and say, you know, do you know anything about this? And they would deny it because, of course, it's some sort of psyop. But they can't figure that out. The police can't. They think that it's some sort of amazing little terrorist organisation or covert, like Palestine Action-style organisation. And they're always erring on the side of caution when it comes to anything which is about the Palestine campaigners. The police really do seem to be opposed to them, whilst there's some brilliant videos going on around that. A lot of the Palestine campaigners, Martin, have been going up to the police saying, I support the genocide, is that okay? And the police just nod and say, that's fine.
You see, I can't quite understand what you're saying.
I support genocide. Well, yeah, that's right. They're saying I support Netanyahu and the genocide, and the police say, yeah, that's fine.
Yes, well, obviously there's a
it's not, is it?
The hypocrisy of these things is unbelievable. So you've got the Home Secretary Mahmoud saying today that perhaps the people should call off. Consciously, there's a big demonstration in London tomorrow because it's the second anniversary of this massacre that's going on in Gaza, and also there's Palestine Action are planning to take over 1,000 people to oppose the ban on Palestine Action, and the police have said, well, because we're worried that there's going to be further attacks on synagogues or maybe
they're very sensitive
mosques, so we need to keep
they're very sensitive to Zionist sentiments. They're not sensitive to the 80 or so Palestinians that are being massacred every day, are they?
No, they're not. And the other thing, of course, is if we've got to protect, the police need to be out there protecting synagogues and mosques, which is the line they're taking, then maybe Tommy Robinson's demonstrations this weekend should be banned. If we're going to ban demonstrations, let's ban all demonstrations. In Northern Ireland, of course, there were questions about who could demonstrate and who couldn't. Bloody Sunday was an illegal demonstration, which is why the Parachute Regiment thought it was okay to shoot it down. And, of course, there's a guy on trial for that as we speak, in Belfast.
I noticed also we've got a new Archbishop today, a lady.
Yeah.
Not sure of her name, but anyway, she's she went in her speech. I mean, this stuff is also stage managed by PR people now. Of course, she might have been going to give a sermon or something, but they had some. She gave a sermon in an address in a church, which is so obvious. Like, this is a gift to all of the media. You can take sound bites from it. She wouldn't normally have done that, but anyway, because she's not even Archbishop yet. But anyway, she had this to say, and of course, she didn't mention Gaza at all in her speech, but she did say this.
In our fractured and hurting world, that partnership in the gospel could not be more vital. Hope is made infinite, is made of the infinite love of God, who breathed life into creation and said it was good. Hope shimmered in the courage of Abraham and Sarah, and the challenging call of the prophets. Hope resounded through Mary's yes to God's call to bear his son. Hope is found in Christ's triumph over sin and death. Hope doesn't skip over grief, pain, and the messiness of life, but enters into it and tenderly tells us that God is with us. Across our nation today, we are wrestling with complex moral and political questions: the legal right of terminally ill people to end their own life, our response to people fleeing war and persecution to seek safety and refuge, the pressures on communities who have been overlooked and undervalued, the deep-rooted question of who we are as a nation in a world that is so often on the brink. Mindful of the horrific violence of yesterday's attack on a synagogue in Manchester, we are witnessing hatred that rises up through fractures across our communities. I know that the God who is with us draws near to those who suffer. We then, as a church, have a responsibility to be a people who stand with the Jewish community against anti-Semitism in all its forms. Hatred and racism of any kind cannot be allowed to tear us apart. In every church, you will encounter Jesus Christ and his teaching to love one another, our source and our standard. This is both gift and responsibility. Jesus Christ is the life-changing hope that brings us together as church, even in our own brokenness and messiness, and sends us out into the world to witness to that love.
So that's Sarah Mullally, who's the new Archbishop of Canterbury. There's been lots and lots of wrangling about this. Worth also mentioning that Archbishop Welby, who was elbowed out last year, coincidentally, of course, had been complaining about the Israelis imprisoning Christians and actually started an entire Church of England campaign to get a Christian released from jail over in Israel and Palestine. And a couple of weeks later, he was given his cards.
Well, I understand he was removed because of protecting various paedophile activities, but of course that doesn't mean
I think he actually protected. He just apparently didn't do exactly the right procedures.
Yes, well,
you know as well as I do, there are all sorts of layers to these sorts of decisions. A big announcement is made, it's not necessarily the reason that we're given, the actual reason why someone has been hoofed out.
Well, it's right to ask questions, Tony, but of course they are just questions until you've resolved them with answers. The fact is that the Church of England has been, you know, like, has been wishy-washy on a lot of this stuff. I'm speaking to the Reverend Sue Parfitt the other day.
Why didn't she mention Gaza there? She's talking about the attack on the mosque.
Well, she should have done. She should have mentioned it, but she didn't. And that I suppose what we were arguing earlier, that if this is a false flag terrorist attack, as you seem to be suggesting, and I'm not saying it's not, that of course then puts pressure on her as she comes into office to speak out about that rather than Gaza. That's the whole point of these things, if that's what's going on.
We have also the Labour Party conference this week. A little short interview was put up by Channel 4 News. Wasn't actually included in Channel 4 News. But here is the Labour MP, Barry Gardiner, being interviewed about Gaza.
People see this. They go on their phones. They see the same images that you and I see. And they see those children. I cannot understand how you can be a foreign secretary, a prime minister, and think that you don't take the strongest possible stand against this.
Well, what was interesting to me about the Labour Party conference this week is, despite the leadership's wishes, the conference voted on a motion through my union, Unison, Tony, that's one of my unions, because they're affiliated to the Labour Party and part of the TUC. They put a motion forward that that there should be an embargo on Israel, that basically an arms embargo should be put on Israel. Which, of course,
well, the opposite's happening. There's massive increases in the amounts of weapons being
indeed,
shipped
but the
from
Labour
Britain
Party
to Israel.
Conference instructed the Labour government to bring in.
Well,
that's
they'll ignore that, won't they?
They will, but in other, of course, in Spain, Ireland, Norway, Belgium. That's going to happen, and in Italy, Meloni doesn't like it, but in actual fact, she's on the way out. And I think that, of course, what's happened with Palestine now is that the left all over Europe is now rallying behind the Palestinians' cause, and of course, it's actually rejecting a lot of this pro-US.
Now,
and of course, ultimately, of course, we need to liberate ourselves from the Israelis and the US.
Now, last week, you were talking about civil war. Now, I think you're right that there may be civil war if the government decides it's going to set itself pro-genocide against the feelings of the nation and against the democratic will of the nation, that it thinks to itself, well, we've managed to get into power, we don't actually care what people think anymore, we're just going to do what we want. That is actually a recipe potentially for civil war, isn't it? Especially in the middle of a genocide.
Yes, and of course countries like Spain have had civil war recently in the Basque region. We've had it in Ireland. Belgium, there's a potential war between the French-speaking and Flemish-speaking people. In Ukraine, it's a massive civil war. There's a civil war in Yugoslavia when I used to be an aid worker in the 1990s. That is still bubbling away. And, of course, it's going to create loads of refugees, just as the destruction. Syria is now in the midst of a civil war that was started years ago by our own intelligence services in order to overthrow Assad. Okay, there's a potential for a civil war inside Israel,
wasn't it? Yeah. Dumas that talked about that when it is. This is when yep. David Miliband was foreign secretary.
That's right.
This is in the Brown government.
Yep.
That the British were organising a bunch of mercenary jihadis to go and overthrow the government of Syria. Now,
that's
that probably
right.
Wouldn't be the first time, would it? Because the British have been interfering in that area for a long, long time.
They have, and of course, what most mainstream pundits, your Julia Hartley Brewers and all the rest of it, do not get can't get their heads round. Because it's an
or
actual
don't want
fact.
To get their
they
heads
don't want
round.
To get their head round. Everybody in the Middle East knows very, very well, like Christians in Syria, for example, know very well that the extreme jihadis are the pawns of British intelligence. And the British were the lead agency on Operation Cyclone into Afghanistan
because of the contacts that they had
with all of these Islamic
let's
extremists.
Be fair, CIA too.
Yeah, but the CIA basically farmed it out to the British because of the empire, yeah, they had loads of contacts in places like Pakistan that the Americans didn't have.
Anyway, okay? I know you're a big fan of Neil Oliver because he's been talking about civil war too.
Is it just me, or is there talk of civil war all around us? Not just war, mind you, not just common or garden war, but civil war. Mainstream media and alternative commentators alike are close now to making civil war closer to a promise than a threat. I've talked before about how hot tempers are now, and justifiably so. I've also said that while I know there's inevitably talk of pitchforks and flaming torches on the streets, that I believe the mob is always and only a tool of those who would goad ordinary people into violent action against their neighbours' homes and businesses and everything else besides. I believe that sort of chaos and carnage only and always serves the so-called elites. Am I the only one who's noticed that the relentless insistence on the imminence of civil war comes when so-called leaders are as unpopular as they've been in generations? Arguably as unpopular as they've ever been. Here in Britain, we have a Prime Minister, Labour's Keir Starmer, with an approval rating of minus 44%, having lost his deputy and most recently his ambassador to the United States of America, third time unlucky Peter Mandelson, bestie of the world's most famous paedophile, Jeffrey Epstein, whatever he is, having plenty to occupy his hands in the cabinet office, more like rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. Starmer must read in the papers day on day that he's about as popular as the proverbial fart in a spacesuit. I'm not even sure just how you can have an approval rating so far below zero. But then, numbers never were my strong suit. Keir Starmer is less popular at home than Donald Trump is in the United States. He's less popular than the Japanese Prime Minister Shigeru Ishiba, who had to resign last year. Only French Prime Minister Emmanuel Macron is more unpopular at home than Starmer. That little Frenchman is on minus 53% after 8 years in power. Giorgia Meloni of Italy is on minus 28%. Friedrich Merz of Germany is on minus 38%. What I'm saying is, isn't it obvious what's going on here? Across the board, certainly across the West, those that we're led to believe have their hands on the levers of power have approval ratings in the toilet. And right when they're all clinging on by their fingernails, actually, more likely being held in place by those really making the decisions and not yet inclined to perform the coup de grace by cutting any more puppet strings, right when it's plain the respective peoples of the countries have had more than enough, the mood music, the earworm being planted is civil war. It's well said that wars don't settle who's right, only who's left. It's well said too that the only terrorism is state terrorism. It's well said, as well as it was by US General Smedley Butler, that, quote, war is a racket. It always has been. It's possibly the oldest, easily the most profitable, surely the most vicious. It's the only one international in scope. It's the only one in which the profits are reckoned in dollars and the losses in lives, close quote. All of that is true, but civil war. Worth remembering that civil war is the worst of all wars, always has been and always will be, and yet it's civil war that we're being promised out, like by killing our neighbours we'll fix anything for ourselves. Leaders all over should be looking at the exit, should be watching what's happening in Nepal, just as a for instance, where politicians have been chased into rivers wearing only their underwear by angry mobs. Although, to be fair, it looks like the angry students in Nepal have been stirred up by agents of the United States of America looking to push, you've guessed it, regime change. But when those at the top know they're in serious trouble, loathed by their populations, what do we hear but the promise of inevitable civil war? Which is to say, right when the righteous anger of people should be focused on those who've actually made lives miserable, if not unlivable, right when the powerful have sown perpetual war here, there and wherever, right when national borders and national identities have been deliberately dismantled by those powerful, right then, right now, what are the people being expected to think must come next? Why, taking up arms, not against the powerful, but against each other, against other people just like them, or other people with even less in the scheme of things.
So do you like Neil Oliver a little bit more after that, Martin?
Well, he's obviously got interesting things to say.
On Nepal is fascinating.
Well, I mean, what he's saying about...
I'd rather like to see that, herding some of our politicians into the River Thames in their underwear.
Yeah, there's a bit of a contradiction in what he's saying there, is that we don't want civil war, but what's happened in Nepal is quite close to civil war. People have died in this uprising.
He's saying it's the colour revolution, which isn't really a civil war,
well,
is it? Says,
well, yes, but colour revolution's become civil war.
He's talking about
getting
people fighting other poor people rather than the people who are controlling them.
Well, I think that's right, but that is exactly what they do. I mean, look what Israel is doing in the neighbouring countries. They are supporting various factions, like the Druze in Syria, and the Christians in Lebanon, yeah, the Kurds in Syria and in Iraq, and it's a way of creating conflict between different groups so that they can rule
the mass,
divide
the
and
mass
rule
media,
classic stuff.
The mass media is doing this because they are pushing the Tommy Robinson line. As I was saying the other week, we hear on the bulletins, we hear Tommy Robinson speaking from a platform. We don't hear anything from Jeremy Corbyn or Barry Gardiner or
Zach Polanski.
Well, we do hear from him, actually, yes, of course, we will. I'm talking about people who are doing political rallies in Trafalgar Square, etc. So we did hear from Robinson, but no, but so the mainstream media are actually pushing this whole idea that, you know, actually the real problem is the Muslims and making it a Muslim-Jewish thing. Well, actually, it's nothing to do with that. This is exactly the scenario that the intelligence services have been creating for us.
They have over many years. And, of course, it serves two purposes. The jihadis inside Syria, for example, have got rid of a government that the West didn't like. Of course, they're actually killing loads of Christians, Alawites and Druze. But, hey, what's not to like? There's
been
no election,
so obvious now, isn't it? I mean, actually, the guy we had on last week, I thought was Jalani. It's not. It's actually the Syrian president, not the prime minister, who was at the United Nations. But the point is that this guy has now got a platform. He's another one of these controlled puppets who stood up at the UN reading a script written in Washington or maybe Westminster.
Well, that's right. I mean, most people, unless they know the history, they're easily misled about what's happening. Yeah. So something like what happened yesterday, obviously an horrific event. Let's just make that clear to anybody listening. That is an absolutely unacceptable piece of... it's not theatre, it's evil. But, of course, the evil may well be the heart of that evil, not just in Gaza, but in general. The 9/11 attacks, for example, five Israeli spies were filming that, the first plane hitting the first building. And, of course, they were arrested. They went back to Israel. They said, yes, we are, Mossad. We were just documenting the event. But it's a surprise attack. So that makes you a prime suspect. I'm coming back to Sherlock Holmes. The same with COVID. The Israeli Defense Forces told the Jerusalem Post that they were given a tip-off in November 2019 that a pandemic was coming out of China. How did they know? How did the Defense Intelligence Agency of the United States know? Kirillov, who was murdered in Moscow, was the head of the Russian chemical and biological warfare troops, General Kirillov. He was also a scientist. He was putting forward we think that this is actually COVID, is in fact a deliberately created and deliberately released. The Iranians were saying that. Salami, who was killed recently. Yeah,
but anyway, the background to all of this, which hasn't been properly analysed at all, we've got this amazing idea that Tony Blair will become the ruler of Gaza.
It's mind-boggling. It's mind-boggling, isn't it? This guy... This is still a member of the Labour Party, unlike Jeremy Corbyn, who's got kicked out by the apparatchiki. He's still a member of the Labour Party, and he's in theory, he's going to be the governor of Gaza and pay millions in order to tell the Palestinians what to do. The Palestinians, of course...
What to do with the rubble.
Yes.
So, anyway, the Middle East Eye have got some leaked documents about what is being proposed quietly. Of course, we're public are not being told this, not even via the BBC being told this, but Middle East Eye have got it, a few other outlets. I think ABC in Australia has got it. Billionaires, Zionists... And a UN official, Tony Blair's proposed team for Gaza, called Aria Lightstone, Naguib Soris, Mark Rowan and Sigrid Karg were named in the leaked Blair plan for Gaza. And so these people are billionaires, hedge fund owners. Earlier this week, a draft plan, which I'll put a link to on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, of what Gaza's governance would look like under Tony Blair, was leaked. Blair, who took Britain into the war in Iraq, illegal war in Iraq, and has spent his life since leaving office, travelling around the world, making money and building influence, is being considered to be the lead transitional authority, to lead the transitional authority in the Palestinian enclave. The plan for Gaza International Transitional Authority, GITA, reveals a hierarchy in which an international board of billionaires and business people sit at the top, whilst highly vetted neutral Palestinian administrators are at the bottom.
Well, it's blatant colonialism, isn't it? Absolutely blatant.
But I mean, you know, surely people in Gaza are now prepared to do anything just to get a ceasefire, aren't they?
I think that's a question for the people of Gaza. if they decide that they've had enough and they want to get and they want to
there
get,
is,
get
there in, is resistance
that's up
against
to them. But
Hamas.
If they want to fight on, they've got my 100% support.
I totally agree with you. But there are many people in Gaza who do blame Hamas for starting this, that saying that it all went off half cock and it was a complete disaster. It's been a complete disaster. So there's, although we don't really hear much about it here, we've heard from various of our correspondents, including Wafa Aludani and people like that over the years, that there is, I think it was the Band documentary. They had one of the opening scenes in the Band the documentary, the BBC Band, which was brilliant a few months ago. Somebody saying, cursing Hamas, basically, a Palestinian saying they brought all this on us. So there is resistance within Palestine to Hamas. And of course, it's possible, surely, that Hamas could just say, okay, we give up, dissolve, and walk away, and then maybe reform and join Islamic Jihad or another group, Fatah or someone.
I think it's very hard to say what everybody in Gaza thinks. And, of course, a lot of people are dead.
They want it to end.
But maybe they do, Tony. But maybe some of them have reached the point. What was it Winston Churchill
said? There's a bit too much pontification from outside going on here.
Well, indeed, there is. But if the Hamas leadership, they've got 40,000 young men down in those tunnels who are armed and ready to fight.
So they refuse to join Islamic Jihad to get a ceasefire, do they?
No, Islamic Jihad haven't called for a ceasefire.
No. For the American... What? Look, you're not listening. You're not listening. Now listen. Are you listening? The Americans have said they want Hamas gone, and if Hamas is gone, then there'll be a ceasefire. Now, when that will happen is a little bit flaky, but the idea of Hamas, surely Hamas could just dissolve, and then those people who were part of Hamas could join another group.
Well, the Jewish fighting group in the Warsaw Ghetto, there was no point fighting, really, because there was no possibility of victory. None whatsoever. But they decided, rather than just go to Auschwitz without fighting, we're going to fight back. And they did fight back, because they got help from the army of Krajowa, the Polish Home Army, got weaponry into the ghetto, and it didn't save anybody, Tony. Didn't save anybody. They all went to Auschwitz in the end, but they killed some of the SS on the way, and some of the Ukrainian SS, who were very much involved in that little battle. Now, I would say that the young lads in Gaza are exactly the same position. Most of their families have already been killed, and all they've got to do now is kill Israeli soldiers, as many as possible, before they're all killed themselves.
Well, I wonder what the ladies think and the kids think.
Well,
maybe any kind of ceasefire is better than the continuation.
I don't agree.
You've just said you want them to decide and you don't agree. Who cares what you think?
Okay, they'll make the decision.
All I'm saying is that there are lots of people there.
There's no reason.
That just stop shouting, that just want this to end. And I think you should understand that. And I take your point of view that, a lot of the youngsters want to continue to fight. But I'm just a little bit fed up with hearing pontification from outside.
All right, well, if what
when
happens
what we've got if, is basically a billionaire's club run by Tony Blair turning... I mean, it's perverse, isn't it? This idea of a sort of Riviera on the Mediterranean.
Well, it's not going to work if you've still got 40,000 fighters in the tunnels that they haven't defeated. The Israeli army knows very well that they haven't defeated them. In actual fact, they're in a stronger position militarily than they were at the beginning. They're better trained now, they're better armed, they've got loads of explosives. It's going to make the Warsaw ghetto uprising led to the Warsaw uprising, which the whole of Warsaw was wiped out. At the beginning of the uprising, everybody cheered the Polish Home Army. At the end of it, they were cursing them. But of course, it's still part of Polish history that we didn't go down without a fight. And the Palestinians are going to think, if I was a Palestinian young man, that's what I would do.
Well,
believe.
Isn't that this part of the live free or die idea?
That's right, yeah.
So anyway, so the massive collaboration with the genocidalists is going on within the Labour Party, Keir Starmer's Labour Party here in Britain. These people, do you think they'll ever end up at war crime trials?
I think either they will end up at war crimes trials, or because, don't forget, 2025 has become the year of decapitation strikes. So Netanyahu has deliberately, and Trump, they've actually killed loads of political leaders that they don't like. There was an attempt on Putin by the Ukrainians, remember? Now that means that Keir Starmer, Donald Trump, anybody in a position of authority in the West, you can hardly complain if somebody, the Russians, the Palestinians, Islamic Jihad, decides to make you pay the price and your children cry. What about that?
What about Peter Mandelson being the real Prime Minister here in Britain? And maybe he doesn't really care that he's been booted out from the US ambassador job, because really he'd rather be in London running the show.
Well, in actual fact, he's not going to. He's got plenty of money, hasn't he? He hangs around with all these wealthy
people.
No,
but he's not interested in. Well, okay. So yes, he does, but he's very interested in political power, isn't he?
He's closer to power than many people realise, but of course he's now been pushed out because of this stuff about
Epstein.
He's
not been pushed out. He's not been pushed out. He's still a very powerful force in London, as we're about to hear.
Yes, okay.
So this is from Double Down News, Richard Sanders.
There's an end of days feel about the Starmer government at the moment. It's been absolutely buffeted by a series of scandals. There's a real sense of the government unravelling before our eyes. The last few weeks, Keir Starmer has lost his deputy prime minister, his director of strategy, and now his ambassador to Washington. The Mandelson story really epitomises the moral and intellectual bankruptcy of this sort of very closed political media class that runs Britain at the moment. Trevor Phillips, who does Sky's key Sunday morning politics show. Peter Mandelson was best man at Trevor Phillips' wedding.
Good morning, Lord Mandelson.
Good morning. Robert Peston from ITV is now saying, oh, why weren't questions asked? Peston had Mandelson on his show. Didn't ask him a thing about Epstein. What he asked him about was the Labour MP, Andy MacDonald, having used a version of the expression, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free.
Your colleague, Andy MacDonald, who'd used that phrase, which many people think is anti-Semitic, from the river to the sea. Do you think he was too slow to remove the whip?
Not in the least, no.
Cathy Newman and myself were always very frustrated, you know, having revealed 6 years ago that Jeffrey Epstein referred to Peter Mandelson as Petey. It was always quite extraordinary. You would see Mandelson interviewed again and again. He was frequently in the media and eventually, of course, got this plum job in Washington. He was never queried on it. It was a question he was never asked.
Pleased to say Lord Mandelson is with us. Thank you for joining us, my lord.
Firstly, the sort of elephant in the room here is that Mandelson was a master of the dark arts.
I'm now the Dark Lord, by the way, not the Prince of Darkness. As you can see, I exude light.
Transparency.
Transparency and bonhomie. Yeah.
They appointed him to Washington, not despite this. It's because of this. Precisely because he was the type of man he was that they thought he'd be useful for dealing with Trump. That's why they appointed him.
What a beautiful accent. I'd like to have that accent. Thank you.
My mother would be proud.
Here you have a man who has spent a lot of time with Epstein. Who knows what Epstein knows about Mandelson? Jeffrey Epstein clearly had connections in the world of intelligence. Very, very likely he had connections to Mossad. You can certainly see how the whole thing could ring alarm bells from a security perspective.
The security services did raise concerns about the potential appointment of Peter Mandelson, Lord Mandelson, as ambassador in Washington, as Britain's person in the US. However, Number 10 overrode those concerns and appointed him anyway.
It now emerges that Peter Mandelson and he were very close friends and they were spending Christmas together. They seem to have spent Epstein's birthdays together. Jeffrey Epstein had two massages a day from underage girls. It's very hard to see how anyone could spend any time with Epstein without realizing the centrality of underage girls in his lifestyle. The revolting thing about the birthday book, Jeffrey Epstein's lifestyle, is clearly a sort of inside joke. Peter Mandelson's entry is 10 pages long. He's taken the trouble to put 10 pages together. Pictures and then little statements underneath. He refers to Epstein as my best pal. That's under a picture of Peter Mandelson in a bathrobe sitting chatting to Jeffrey Epstein. He says, we love you. At the end of it, there's also a reference to the Epstein's wonderful houses, which he shares with his friends. And then in brackets, yum, yum, which is an extremely strange and rather disturbing thing to have said. When Epstein gets into trouble with the authorities in 2007, 2008, Mandelson is one of no doubt many men he turns to for help and advice. This is the extraordinary thing. It's not just that Mandelson maintains the relationship. Mandelson is intimately involved and is advising Epstein on how he can fight these charges against him. These are emails from Mandelson to Epstein. And this one's February 2008, when Epstein is fighting the charges against him. Mandelson, you are fighting back, so you need strategy, strategy, strategy. Remember the art of war. And then after Epstein is finally convicted, far from distancing himself from Epstein, Peter Mandelson writes, I think the world of you, and I feel hopeless and furious about what has happened. I can still barely understand it. It just could not happen in Britain. You have to be incredibly resilient, fight for early release, and be philosophical about it as much as you can. Everything can be turned into an opportunity, and that you will come through it and be stronger for it. The whole thing has been years of torture, and now you have to show the world how big a person you are and how strong. Your friends stay with you and love you. Where does this story go from here? Firstly, there continue to be very awkward questions for Keir Starmer to answer about what he knew when. But I think it ripples out beyond that. There's a couple of stories that have just not been picked up on at all. People keep talking about how Mandelson maintained his relationship with Epstein after he had been convicted of the crime of molesting young girls. Now, we've known that for ages. What emerged in the reporting was that he not only retained that relationship, he was actively working to help Epstein get off the charges. I mean, the emails are quite extraordinary. One very interesting thing he does, Epstein writes to him in the summer of 2008 and says, your man, Gordon Brown, then Prime Minister, is meeting with Bush in Washington in a few days. Could he put in a word for me with Bush's chief of staff? Mandelson doesn't come back and say, no, that would be completely inappropriate. He comes back and says, actually, the meeting's already happened and the relevant person wasn't there and so on. So clearly that didn't go anywhere. But it's very revealing that Epstein was even asking that of him. It suggests that Mandelson was prepared to use his connections to the heart of power to try and help Epstein and his legal difficulties. And it does raise the question, did Peter Mandelson simply share the view that Epstein and others around him had that these girls just didn't matter? They were just sort of expendable. It's also a really interesting story that almost no one's picked up on in the Times. The Times revealed that there was a memo that has been suppressed. It's not been released to the public. It's a memo from Peter Mandelson to Tony Blair in which he recommends that Blair meets this man, Jeffrey Epstein. Not for any particular reason. There's nothing to discuss. He simply thinks that Epstein would be an interesting person for Blair to meet. Now, that in itself is very interesting. The Times then does a rather odd thing. It says it is unclear if any meeting took place. And you're thinking, well, didn't you ask? I mean, the absolutely blindingly obvious thing to do in the wake of that is to fire off a message to the Tony Blair Institute. Have you ever met Jeffrey Epstein?
That's actually entitled, Is This Britain's Real Prime Minister? Richard Sanders on Double Down News there, giving us a real good insight, I think, into the role of Mandelson. Martin, I mean, you seem to think he's kind of out of the picture. I doubt it very much. I think he and Blair are very big figures within the Labour Party, and that Keir Starmer will read out anything that they stick in front of his nose.
Yes, but it started to unravel to some extent in ways that they couldn't have anticipated. The main point about all of this, which people are missing, is Epstein was working for Mossad. This was not
Ghislaine Maxwell seems to have been the mastermind of that little
operation.
That's
right, because her father, Robert Maxwell, was a Mossad agent for years and years and years.
And she's still around. She was the one that was finding the girls.
That's right. But it isn't just about, gosh, isn't this terrible they've been abusing young girls? Of course it's terrible, but the purpose of that is to blackmail people, which is why the political class in both the US and Britain is supporting genocide in Gaza. I'll bet you Trump, they've got loads of stuff on Trump. Masses of stuff.
Lammy,
which is what
Lammy, man.
All of them will be implicated one way or another.
Starmer?
Well, we'll have to see, because Starmer's implicated via Mandelson, at the very least. All of them are very, very pro-Israeli, and in defiance of public opinion, even in the United States.
In defiance of common sense.
In defiance of common sense.
Normal humanity.
That's
even
right.
A child can see this is
that's
not
right.
Something he's
that's right. Well, anybody can see. I mean, obviously, what Trump promised is he was going to release the Epstein files, and as soon as he came to power, he said, well, we're not going to do that, because we've all got
but
to move
been,
on.
No, there has been a massive, I don't know if it's all of the Epstein files, enormous amount of about a month ago, was put into the public domain. In fact, there were other things that were happening that day which diverted a lot of people from it. But, I mean, I think
a
Trump
lot of
has
the
made,
important stuff has not come out.
Maybe.
He said they were... And, of course, the question... It's quite clear that Trump has had dealings with Epstein over many, many years. Okay? No doubt Epstein has got photos and videos of Trump with underage girls. It wouldn't be surprising, would it?
He's a bit of a chancer, old Mandelson. But the other thing that happens in this country these days, particularly with this genocide-supporting government of Keir Starmer, where actually, of course, the as we were discussing earlier, Jeremy Corbyn was blocked by these people from becoming Prime Minister back in 2017. And Starmer was then spatchcocked in order to so that they could have their control, is the way that they target journalists who are investigating. It's just that once you're a crooked, corrupt government, the only thing you've really got to fear is exposure by people like the Daily Mail. Now, you were just talking about Epstein, Martin, and you know, this idea of blackmail. Well, the person who has been exposed all over the national newspapers all over the world is Prince Andrew, and everybody else that's on Epstein's list knows exactly what to expect if they step out of line now, don't they? They're going to get the Andrew treatment.
Well, that's right. That's the whole point. I mean, what the way Mossad operates is they do lots of nasty things, assassinations, blackmail, and of course they do, and you know, when they feel comfortable, they will even boast about it. But the point is that many people don't realise what they're doing, like the general public are, you know, largely, you know, the idea that they might have been behind yesterday's synagogue attack doesn't cross their minds. People like us, it's the sort of thing we might think about, but of course, the people who can see through it, the people like us, we are then intimidated because we know that they are capable of doing these things. So either way, it's a win-win. Apart from the fact that they're about to go to war with Iran, it looks like they're moving all of these refueling planes from the US to Europe. And when they go to war with Iran, then we're going to see what World War III looks like.
Last week we heard McSweeney-gate. There were a couple of McSweeney-gate stories last week, actually, about this guy Morgan McSweeney. We had a story from a few weeks ago how his family in Ireland are making masses of money and swinging planning permission to put up hostels to house asylum seekers and migrants over in Ireland. And, of course, we know anyone that's been following this in Greece and Italy, there is a strong connection with the mafia there as running places where migrants are being put up by the government. They're making an absolute fortune, the mafia in Italy and Greece doing this, and obviously Morgan McSweeney too is part of a kind of mafia. But what about all the criticism of McSweeney by journalists and people digging into his past? Because the Labour Party and The Guardian did everything. I mean, last week's book was called The Thing They're Most Afraid Of. The fraud, the thing they're most afraid of is exposure, and that's what's in this book we were hearing from Mark Holden. Anyway, he's released another video yesterday explaining how The Guardian and the Labour government got together to try to destroy him as a journalist as he was researching this book.
This is the shocking story about how a Labour MP at the heart of political power by the name of Josh Simons, who before he became an MP decided it was a good idea to hire a reputation management firm to look into me, an investigative journalist, looking into his organisation, Labour Together. About 4 years ago, I got access to a phenomenal leak of documents out of the Labour Party. That sparked my investigation into Morgan McSweeney and the Labour Party, an incredible story of the reckless and arguably lawless project that has delivered us this Keir Starmer government. In November 2023, the Sunday Times ran a front-page story based on the documents that I gave to it. It raised serious concerns about whether the donations that Morgan McSweeney had failed to report had not been reported on purpose. At the bottom of that article, it simply said that Paul Holden, that's me, had given certain documents to the Sunday Times and formed part of their investigation. On the 8th of February 2024, Pippa Creer, the deputy political editor of The Guardian, sent me an email. Pippa Creer's email said that The Guardian was 24 hours away from running a story that would allege that I was under investigation by the UK security services for receiving information stolen by Russia from a hack of the Electoral Commission. The story was nonsense. I hadn't received a single document from Russia. I would never receive a document from Russia. This is an unbelievable story. When I told Pippa Creer that the allegations were false, that in fact I would sue The Guardian for defamation if they reprinted that story, the story disappeared. Labour Together had tried to convince the National Cyber Security Centre to investigate me. I don't think they were very successful, as I've never heard from the NCSC, either before or after Pippa Creer's email. A couple of weeks after that, I got a phone call from an old friend of mine from South Africa, an absolutely fearsome investigative journalist. At the time, she'd been working on a series of stories about how there were reputation management companies in the UK who are hired by the likes of multinational companies, arms companies, BP, Shell, tobacco companies, to make sure their reputation isn't tarnished by people like me, by whistleblowers, people who report on corruption. She called me in 2024 and said, I should let you know, your name has come up in my investigation. You are the person of interest. They're doing investigations into you. They're trying to figure out who you are and who your family is. And I said to her, well, you know, who was the client behind this investigation? And she came back to me and she said, Labour Together. And I said, well, who's on these emails? A young man by the name of Josh Simons. Now, Josh Simons was the director of Labour Together between late 2022 and mid 2024.
To her right is Josh Simons, who is the director of Labour Together, a political think tank founded to make Labour electable again, that works closely with Sir Keir Starmer and his team. He first worked for Labour as a party staffer under Jeremy Corbyn before resigning over anti-Semitism.
During the 2024 general election, he was parachuted into a safe seat and now sits as a Labour MP, recently promoted by Keir Starmer, to the parliamentary secretary in the Cabinet Office.
We need to bring some integrity, some faith, some sense that politics is actually a profession of nobility to pursue that requires people of good character.
Frequently appearing on shows like Politics Joe, talking about how politicians have lost the trust of the public.
Trust in elected politicians, in the things that we say that we can do, in whether we actually want to do the things that we say we want to do, is so completely broken.
I wonder why. Between 2017 and 2020, Labour Together ran an undisclosed secret project to destroy the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn. With a pot of money, £730,000, Morgan McSweeney wasn't declaring as required by law to the Electoral Commission. What McSweeney did was produce a detailed presentation of what the Labour Party membership wanted and who they would vote for. They were able to present a pitch of Keir Starmer as a radical eco-socialist, an inheritor of the Corbynite tradition, that he will unite the party and end factionalism. But nothing could be further from the truth. The fraudulent pitch that Keir Starmer offered was based entirely on Morgan McSweeney's vision of him polling the membership, understanding what needed to be said to get Labour members to vote for a leader who would then betray them.
Keir had to win. That was the most important thing. And if in the Labour Party you win the leadership of the Labour Party, you quite quickly run the whole thing. You can take all the reins and you can take control over the whole institution and you can frankly smash the institution to pieces and rebuild it again. And that is what he did. And in order to do that, in order to do what he's done in a very, very short space of time, he had to be smart and strategic, as you always are in American politics. You start from the left and you tack to the center. That's how you win. Politics is about power. It's an all or nothing game.
That explanation rests upon two assertions. One is that he knew that Corbyn was going to lose. And the other is that he pretended to support him when he didn't really. How do you answer that?
Now, Josh Simons, before he became an MP, who was the director of Labour Together, had hired a firm that was looking into me, into my family, and into my colleagues. They use sophisticated data scraping tools and intelligence techniques to find out where and who I lived with. They had to do that because I've tried to keep that secret as I can, because I don't have social media. And I don't have social media because when I was in South Africa, those sorts of things were used to harass me, to find out where I lived, and to target me with targets of burglaries. I was told that the investigative firm that had been hired by Labour Together finally alighted on an incredible allegation that I was connected to Russian intelligence through South African intelligence structures, despite the fact that I spent quite a lot of my career investigating Russian oligarchs, and I've actually suffered a series of legal threats as a result.
So that's Mark Holden again. Interesting that I haven't currently come across him much. And he gives a bit of an explanation there. He says, well, I'm not really on social media because social media was used to attack and destroy me. Very much actually, like if you remember Simon Killane, who we had on this programme speaking a couple of months ago about how social media was used to destroy him as a Wiltshire County Councillor when he was standing up to the big planning developers in the area and actually literally destroy him on social media, accusing him of paedophilia, etc., etc. So, Mark Holder's done a pretty good job in drilling into this Labour Together organisation. It's pretty clear they used about £750,000 in order to destroy Corbyn and install Starmer.
Yes, and the £750,000 came from two donors. One of them, Trevor Chin, who's a business person in this country and also very, very pro-Israel. So this money was provided by pro-Israel millionaires, if not billionaires, and then secretly used to capture the Labour Party for the Zionist cause. That's how politics, that's how sausages are made. Yeah.
The book is called The Fraud, Keir Starmer, Morgan McSweeney and the crisis of British democracy. As far as I can remember, I don't think you can actually buy a copy yet, but you can pre-order it. It's due out in November this year. It's based on Labour Party files, their own files, including some never before publicly seen. It lays bare the intrigues, the stratagems and the deceits that helped deliver Keir Starmer to Downing Street. He shows how Keir Starmer has been the front man for a ruthless right-wing political project headed by Morgan McSweeney, who is now Chief of Staff at Number 10, arguably the most powerful man in Britain. McSweeney's clique employed dirty tricks to undermine the left-wing Labour leadership of Jeremy Corbyn, fueling a moral panic over anti-Semitism and establishing front groups that hobbled prominent independent media outlets in the name of fighting misinformation. So this, in a way, the what we're looking at this week is the press side of it, because what they tried to do, Martin, before he'd even brought this book out and got this investigation out there, is to destroy the guy using The Guardian.
Yes, and of course, there's plenty of way. The reality is that the people we're up against will destroy your reputation, accuse you of paedophilia, and then also other things that might happen. You might have a nasty car accident.
Is that what The Guardian is for? Who are they guarding? Israel?
The Guardian is, as you know, is funded by a trust, and it's not quite clear where they get their money from. They got some money from...
I mean, it's like being phoned up by the local mob, isn't it? Hey, we're about to do a hatchet job on you, blah, 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 blah. Have you got anything to say? Yes, I will sue you. And actually, the Guardian then backed off.
Yes.
But that's because McSweeney and his friends were leaning on the Guardian. They had the ability to do that. We want to get a story out through a national newspaper to destroy this investigative journalist we don't like.
Yes. And ultimately, the funding for all of this comes from Israeli sources. So it all fits together. We know
but
what
you know
we're
what? Your
with.
Mandelsonians will be loving all this. They'll go along with it. They don't need to get any money from Israel. They'll be helping out.
No, they
for
get
free.
They get money and perks as well. I mean, this has been going on for a very long time. And of course, what the Israelis are now doing in their attempt to dominate the Middle East, balkanize all the countries nearby, kill loads and loads of people. You know, this is a massive, massive massacre that's going on. It's been planned for years. It's the Yinon plan, the Oded Yinon plan from the 1980s. And of course, it's ultimately going to lead to World War III. And of course, World War III would be very nasty. And at the end of World War III, the end of World War I, the concept of the State of Israel was created by the British Foreign Office. At the end of World War II, through violence, they created a state. And at the end of World War III, it's not unreasonable to imagine that that state may be liquidated, just like Algerie Française.
Well, Press TV, that's a channel I'm on from time to time. The Iranian State English Language News, very good feed they've got. If you ever want to put their RSS feed on or whatever it is, listening live to them, they're very good. I love them anyway. And they let me say anything, even if it's critical of the Iranian president. They don't seem to mind. And I do say some critical things of the Iranian government from time to time on there. But they've been talking this week, Martin, about something I've hardly heard anywhere else, which is the Russians have said, no, we're not having any more sanctions on Iran. At the United Nations, it's the UN plus it's I think they're called the Troika, which is the UK, France and Germany are all insisting on the reimposition of sanctions and upping sanctions on Iran for trying to build a nuclear weapon, which apparently they are, but maybe they're not.
Well, what's interesting about that is that the Americans withdrew from the Joint Cooperation Plan, whatever it was called, so they've got no right to say anything about it because they withdrew, leaving the Troika, Britain, France and Germany, and Russia as the other person. And of course, the Russians are saying, well, there's no evidence to suggest that they've done anything other than cooperate.
Well, the three countries are the UK, France and Germany, not Russia.
No, but Russia's part of the structure that's supposedly in the JCPOA. But they basically said, well, we don't agree with this. Now, what's happening, there was no reason for these European countries to do that. They could have just let the negotiations between the Iranians and the Americans carry on, which is pretty much, you know, and the Iranians are saying, well, even though, of course, as they were negotiating with the Americans, the Israelis attacked them, a sneak attack, while they were talking to them. This is what they do. Yeah, if you negotiate with the Israelis or the Americans, they will assassinate you.
Okay.
People should work that out. I mean, Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse should have worked it out years ago. Chief Joseph of the Nez Perce. Yeah? don't trust them. As Sitting Bull said about the Americans, they made us many promises, more than I can remember, but they only kept one. They promised to take our land, and they took it. You don't negotiate with people
like
that.
Sounds a bit like Gaza, doesn't it?
No, and that's what I would say about what you were saying about Hamas earlier. There is no way, Jose, that if I was a leader of Hamas, I would negotiate with these people.
Or
at
any
all,
Palestinian
no.
leader,
there's
maybe.
No point negotiating yeah. with them. You've just got to fight them.
The Russian ambassador to the United Nations has said his country does not recognise the legitimacy of reimposing the world body sanctions on Iran via the so-called snapback mechanism. We do not recognise the snapback as coming into force, said Vasily Nebenzia. In fact, he's the Russian that speaks more English than anyone else I've heard. I love hearing them speak English. I wish they would a bit more, because everyone can understand English, you silly Russians. He said at a press conference on Wednesday, marking the start of Russia's presidency of the UN Security Council for October. He also censured the Western countries for initiating the illegal snapback procedure, despite being themselves serial violators of Security Council Resolution 223. Which endorsed the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. Now, people get bored talking about the JCPOA. What is this? But actually, isn't it like the most important deal on the entire planet?
Well, I think things like the START deal between the US and Russia are probably more important because they've both got nuclear weapons. But it is important. Of course it is. And the Iranians have basically bent over backwards to show that we do not want nuclear weapons and we're prepared to negotiate with you about it. But of course what they get for that is that their negotiators are then assassinated.
Well, last week we heard that the Israelis may actually be using nuclear weapons, but IAEA are not crawling all over Dimona, are they?
No, and of course they've got the Israeli possession of nuclear weapons, which they got from the Americans by stealing them, and of course there's
an assassinating two potential president and a president.
Because they weren't happy about it. Ultimately, if you know anything about history, the history of the 20th century, this is the edge of World War III, and Israel is going to be at the centre of it. And I dare say, from my point of view, in the end, either we're all going to be wiped out here, or Israel is going to cease to exist.
It's worth. I mean, I'd love
state.
To see it on the BBC. A
they
bit
need
like
to be
I
liquidated.
Would, I think another
not the people, the state.
And I'm just dreaming of this cinema that Tony's going to create, where all of the world leaders have to go through and have the matchsticks put to they're forced to watch. Another documentary is Israel and the Assassination of the Kennedy Brothers by Lawrence Guillenot, who was very kindly interviewed for this program several months ago. This should be well known. That the Israelis, in order to obtain nuclear weapons, did certainly the implication through the documentary shows that it's a highly likely that those that's the reason why JFK was killed and RFK Jr.'s dad was also murdered.
Well, that's right. I mean, what the internet has done over the years that it's existed is people can in fact investigate these things in a way that was previously impossible. And of course, there's plenty of things to find out there, and therefore it can get confusing because there's just so much.
Well, but you know what? There's actually, if you could probably sit down here and list about 10 documentaries which would completely change your view of the world if you watch them. What happens is these things get buried. The algorithms make them very difficult to find. One of those would probably be our investigation into the 7/7 London bombings, which was very comprehensive, and it absolutely pinned it on the Israelis.
Yeah, well, we didn't pin it on the Israelis.
I think we did.
I think they were very much behind it. But, of course, MI5 and MI6 were also implicated.
What about 9/11?
Indeed.
Israel did it. All the proof in the world. There's a very good article on WikiLeaks all about that. So the Israelis are definitely at the centre of world terrorism. They are the terrorist state. So the idea that they carried out what happened yesterday is not at all beyond the pale, is it?
No, it's not. But we should also be very careful to say, be given all the previous evidence, the suggestion that, you see, what people can't get their heads around is, surely the Israelis wouldn't attack a synagogue. And the answer to that is, yes, they would. They did attack synagogues in Iraq in the 1950s. People can check this. They bombed synagogues, killed Jews in Iraq, and then said, oh, it's terrible in Iraq. People are trying to kill you. You'll have to come to Israel. So they then sent planes to take Iraqi Jews to Israel because the Iraqi Jews didn't want to go to Israel.
Well,
they were actually happy where they were.
It was even worse with Hitler, wasn't it?
Yeah, so they go, come to Israel. Yes. Loads of Jews are being killed.
That's what got Ken Livingstone resigned from the Labour Party, because they were complaining about that. But there's overwhelming evidence that the Nazis and the Zionists cooperated in trying to get Jews to go to Israel in the 1930s.
It's called the Transfer Agreement. And in fact, there's a book about written by Edwin Black, who also wrote IBM and the Holocaust, which is one of the subjects we'll be covering straight after the break, which is ID cards, IBM and the Holocaust. So anyway, just as to wind up part one, talking about Israel-Palestine, as we have been almost all the time in the first half, let's have a look at Israel's, the BBC's covering up of the Israeli nuclear weapons program, the naughty BBC, part of the genocide.
Israel's possession of nuclear weapons is an open secret. It has a policy of deliberate ambiguity, never confirming nor denying its possession of nuclear bombs. But ever since 1986, the world has had incontrovertible proof of Israel's weapons program. That was after Israeli nuclear technician and whistleblower Mordecai Vanunu leaked photographs and documents to Britain's Sunday Times. And for publication of those state secrets, Vanunu was kidnapped by the Mossad in Rome, brought back to Israel and sentenced to 18 years in prison for treason and espionage. And more evidence came of Israel's nuclear capability in 2010. That was when The Guardian uncovered official documents from 1975 showing Israel had offered to sell the apartheid government in South Africa nuclear weapons in that same year. Then in 2023, the world got more confirmation when a junior Israeli minister threatened to nuke Gaza. And that led to the suspension of the cabinet minister for breaching the policy of deliberate ambiguity. Of course, you wouldn't get kicked out of cabinet for threatening genocidal actions against the Palestinians. That's perfectly fine. But if you mention nukes, you're in trouble. So Israel's nuclear capabilities are well known and recognized across the political spectrum. So it was surprising to read this earlier this week in a prominent BBC explainer. So the question in this sort of Q&A, so it's called Your Questions Answered on the Israel-Iran Conflict. Your voice, your news. I'm not sure why it says that. In the article, they have this question. Does Israel have nuclear weapons? The real answer is we don't know. They have not confirmed or denied the presence of a nuclear capability. It takes three components to have a nuclear weapon. First, uranium enriched to 60% purity. Second, the ability to build a warhead. And third, a way to deliver that warhead to a target. As it stands, there is no overt declaration by Israel on any form of nuclear capability. Now, this really brings to mind the famous quote. I think no one really knows quite who to ascribe it to, but it's, if one person says it's raining and another says it's not raining, then the journalist should look out the window and report the truth, not say, oh, these guys say this. Israel says it doesn't have a nuclear weapon. It's not even, Israel doesn't even deny it has a nuclear weapon. The answer is we don't know. What the hell is going on there? Is it, at least you can say, oh, Israel denies it has nuclear. Israel refuses to confirm or deny whether it has a nuclear weapon when everyone has incontrovertible proof it does. There are pictures. Right? And in fact, a brave Israeli nuclear technician went to prison for 18 years for revealing to, you know, the world's press that they had this nuclear weapon. And now the BBC says, we don't know. Who can say? There's another subtle problem with this explainer because it says this. In the third paragraph, it says that one of the three components needed for nuclear weapons is uranium enriched to 60% purity. Now, that's just false. The actual requirement is uranium enriched to 90% purity. So where has the 60% figure come from? Well, that's the purity Iran is thought to have achieved. So in the same post, which is supposed to be authoritative from the BBC, the journalist has now not only dramatically downplayed Israel's nuclear capabilities, but exaggerated Iran's.
So there's an investigation into the bomb. I'm quite sure who's done that one. I'm sorry about that. We'll put a link up to all these things, of course, as usual, on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. I do a weekly newsletter that goes out on a Sunday evening, Monday morning. And do check your spam, because for some reason, the email address I sent it from, my main email address, always seems to go to spam. I don't know how someone's managed to do that. It's not because I won't remove people from the list. If you are
are on the list, my weekly newsletter, and you just literally hit reply and ask to be unsubscribed, I'll unsubscribe you. But for some reason, it always goes to spam. A lot of people have been saying this to me recently, but it's there. The information will be there Sunday evening. Now, Martin, this is the BBC being complicit, really, isn't it, in this battle? The BBC are constantly repeating accusations about Iranian nuclear weapons, and yet when they evidence is all out there about Israeli nuclear weapons, they say, well, sorry, we just don't know.
You mean Israeli nuclear weapons in the second half of the sentence? Well, yes, and of course the BBC is paid for by our licence fees and therefore has a duty to be independent and impartial about issues like this. But clearly it isn't. It just isn't. And of course, the BBC is probably better than things like the Daily Telegraph, which are basically just a front organisation for the deep state and Israeli interests.
What about saying that you need 60% enriched uranium, which the Iranians have, to make a nuclear bomb, when that's actually a lie? You need 90% enriched.
Well, I mean, that's basically deliberate misinformation, isn't it? That's deliberate. And therefore, that should lead to whoever made that article being sacked. But it's not going to happen, is it? They probably got promoted.
They may well have done. I mean, this is really a form of mass media complicity with the genocide, isn't it? What you're doing is you're providing cover for the and the antagonists in mass murder.
Well, as various journalists have pointed out, at Nuremberg. Several, or at least one person, who was Volsky Beobachter, he was the editor-in-chief of the Nazis' main newspaper, and he'd not been involved directly in any killing of anybody, but he was hung just for lying. Well, that's the implication that these people need to realise, yeah? There is at the end of, we're either all going to be dead at the end of all of this and nobody will prosper, or ultimately the Western powers in Israel are going to lose, which means ultimately there will possibly be war crimes trials for those who've got us into this mess. The people behind 9/11, for example. Yeah. Those people possibly need to go to trial and maybe to be executed.
Just reading out from this article he's mentioning there, I mean, it's just mind-blowing, isn't it? So this is complete rubbish. The BBC, your questions answered on Israel-Iran conflict. It says the only people who know for certain whether or not Iran is working towards building a nuclear bomb are the most trusted nuclear scientists, most of which have been killed.
Well, the intelligence agencies, insofar as they've remained professional, have been advising all along that they haven't got nuclear weapons. But that's not it's not about nuclear weapons in Iran, it's about regime change. They want to change, this whole stuff about nuclear weapons is just a diversion. They just want Iran finished. They want it smashed. Because, of course, the Iranians are the real threat to the state of Israel.
They've altered, at least the BBC have gone on and changed their article now. Mikey Kay, the security brief host, has now changed it, saying to make a nuclear weapon, you need uranium enriched to 90%. So well done, BBC. You're obviously listening to your critics. And now no one's watching this because it's not on the top of the BBC website anymore. You've now got the figures right. But this is very important, this sort of thing about enriched uranium, isn't it?
It is. And, of course, what you've pointed out is the way they do this is they tell a load of lies. And then if they're picked up on it, they then, yes, I suppose that was lies. But, of course, that's not the impression that people get. Is it? Frankly, the Iranians are in a position to turn around and say, right, we're withdrawing from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, because obviously nobody's taking this seriously. And, of course, there's some military people in Iran, no doubt, are saying, well, if we'd had a nuclear weapon, they wouldn't dare to push us around like this. It's pretty logical, isn't it?
That's what's happened with North Korea.
Yes, that's right. Well, they sleep in their beds without fear of attack.
There are over 20 million Bibles distributed every year, and the Bible can be read aloud in 70 hours, though you might want to take a nap between the Old and New Testaments. 9 out of every 10 Americans own at least one Bible. What's up with the other guy? One person you'd be surprised to hear talk about the Bible is Keb Moe. Listen to what he has to say.
When I look at the Bible and they say this is the book about God's word, I don't think God is that confusing. Why would God write such a confusing book? I think it's written by men trying their best to interpret the word of God. But everything is the word of God because we're all a product of God. I mean, I think God has showed up in many, many books. God showed up in songs. You know, God has showed up in a lot of places. So I think the Bible gets too much credit for being the only word of God.
Here's a song written about Elijah. It's a traditional song performed here by Ulabel and New York band led by Amy Helm, daughter of Levon Helm. Here's Ulabel and their version of Elijah Rock.
Elijah Rock, shout, shout. Elijah Rock, come and upload. Elijah Rock, shout, shout. Elijah Rock, come and upload. Talk about him.
with Amy Helm with Ola Bell and their version of Elijah Rock, a record put out by T-Bone Burnett. He's always been a man of great taste. Thank you, T-Bone. Elijah is a heroic figure in Jewish tradition. Every Passover, a special cup of wine is filled and put on the table. The door of the house is left open and a chair is left empty in case Elijah the prophet decides to come in and join the festivities.
How long will you refuse to humble yourself before God?
If you bring another plague upon us, it is not your God but I who will turn the Nile red with blood.
If there is one more plague on Egypt, it is by your word that God will bring it. And there shall be so great a cry throughout the land that you will surely let the people go.
You said I wasn't a bit of a groove kitten. Martin and I dancing along to Pat Benatar here in the studio, and Dave fading that down a little bit too fast. I don't know where that was. Maybe that was me fading it down fast. Yeah, he's pointing at me. Okay, it was. So that was Love is a Battlefield from 1982. Pat Benatar. Before that, you heard the Rolling Stones, Paint It Black, which in the interview with Andy Gordon we're going to hear in a little while, you'll see why I played that one this week. And before all that, it was Theme Time Radio Hour with Bob Dylan and Elijah Rock by, Ulibel. It's Bob Dylan. If you want to know who it is, just go back and have a look at that edition of Theme Time Radio Hour on the Bible. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The way I think we're going to have to look, the thing we're going to have to look at now, Martin, is the press conference at the United Nations after the Russian presentation. As we were chatting here last week, we had the Colombian on, didn't we? A very interesting chap. What was his name again?
Gustavo Petro.
Very, yeah. I mean, he took 40 minutes. You're only supposed to have 15 minutes. So we've got a mixture at the UN, and it's almost a sort of like a panel show game where you can stand and say, well, is this guy actually saying what he really thinks, or is he another robot? And of course, when Lammy stands up, you know he's a robot. But Gustavo Petro definitely wasn't. There are all sorts of people who around the world who seem to actually be representing their people and saying what they really think. But the number seems to be decreasing year by year. The Russians, though, hadn't spoken this time last week. They have now. And, of course, Lavrov is ever the statesman. I like to think of the Russians, Martin, as doing a sort of role now like Britain was in the run-up to the Second World War.
Well, I'm not quite sure of that.
Yeah, being the sort of smart guys in the room who are saying, you know, actually, watch out. You know, this is what you need to know. This is what you need to do. We've got a bunch of maniacs coming over the horizon. And the Russians are pointing the finger at the United States and Britain. At the time, Britain was pointing the finger at Nazi Germany.
Well, what happened in the... as Alex Craner will tell you, that what happened at Munich was, in actual fact, the Soviets had said, we will come in and protect Czechoslovakia, but we'll have to bring our army into Czechoslovakia to do it. And the West didn't want them to do that. So at that point, Stalin then decided to have the non-aggression pacts with Hitler. Because, of course, what they've been playing for is, we will fight Germany for you. Yeah. And the British, that's what Chamberlain did at Munich. He gave in to the Germans, but the alternative was for the Russians to come in and fight with the Germans, and all we'd have to do is support them. And that would have stopped World War II, but it didn't happen.
No,
it was Britain's fault.
But anyway, I like to think of the Russians now as sort of guys that they're the smart guy in the room that the ladies like, and the ladies like to talk to, because their sons are not going to have to fight and die if they get their way.
Well, look, they are very well aware they've lost probably 100,000 people in this war. That's a very big burden to bear. That's
not as many as the 1.7 million Ukrainians that have died.
No, that's right.
Because, of course, we hear all sorts of twisted figures about this.
That's right. Well, I mean, even Trump was coming out the other day that the Ukrainians can definitely win and they're going to retake Crimea and maybe they can march on to Moscow.
Well, this is one of the questions which was asked at the press conference of Sergei Lavrov at the United Nations. And quite cheekily, the British guy said to him, well, could we please have the answer in English? And the Russians, they are a bit silly because they don't understand that English is the language that so many more people understand. He said, no, Russian is a proper, you'll hear this in a minute, Russia is a proper language, I hope you will, at the United Nations only. If I wish to speak in Russian, I will speak in Russian. So it's almost as if the Brits giving him an opening, but because they so dislike the Brits, they do the opposite of what they should do. But so let's have a little listen now to the Russians do you want to just say something about this, Martin, the Russian attitude to Ukraine at the moment? We've had several things going on, haven't we? Like, for example, Trump saying shoot down Russian planes.
Yes, I mean, this is another big flashpoint in world affairs which could easily lead to a disaster. And of course, we've had all these so-called drone attacks on airfield.
There's a little NATO team, isn't there, going around at the moment from country to country, sending up their drones, causing news stories, trying to implicate the Russians, and then moving on to the next country.
Yes, and in actual fact, of course, it isn't the Russians that are causing all these problems. It's our own secret services. Now, all of these things are illegal.
It's less dangerous than Operation Gladio, when loads of people are getting bombed and killed, just sending a few drones up.
Nevertheless, it's also illegal behaviour, and we are being deliberately pushed down the road to war by our own secret services, who are disturbing.
If you're a copper who discovers who's doing this, and it turns out it's some NATO operative, what chance are you going to have of prosecuting them?
Very difficult to say what that could be, but of course, as I say, that Operation Gladio was investigated by the Italian police, and Imposimato, who's the head of the Italian Supreme Court and the investigating magistrate on many of these cases, he wrote a book in 2012, La Repubblica dei Stragi Impuni, which shows without a shadow of a doubt that NATO is a terrorist organisation. People need to understand that. The Russians, of course, do understand it. As I say, they've lost 100,000 people already in this war.
Okay, let's go over to the UN last weekend, press conference held by Sergei Lavrov, Russian Foreign Minister.
Thank you very much, Foreign Minister. Mark Stone from Sky News. I wonder if I could persuade you to answer a question in English, perhaps. President Trump has called you Russia a paper tiger, has said that European countries should shoot down Russian planes if they violate European airspace. Do you see that as a provocation? And what would happen if Russian planes are shot down? Thank you, sir.
First of all, we are the United Nations, and the Russian language is an official language of the United Nations, as is the English language. So I'm very grateful to all of you for your respect for our right or opportunity to use this language. Frankly speaking, we can't necessarily follow all of the statements that have been made. But I do remember a day or so after the statement was uttered, paper tiger, the next day, President Trump was asked, does he continue to think Russia is a paper tiger? And the response there was negative. So if each nuance in the rhetoric is addressed, well, I already responded to what I think of certain statements from President Trump. In public diplomacy, there are various tools being leveraged, various means, various tricks, various procedures, and as if President Trump allowed for the bombing of Russian Federation, intercepting drones, planes. When a drone flies not over our territory, if it crossed somebody's border, but outside of our airspace, probably everybody has a right to do what they deem necessary with this drone for providing for their own security. But if there are attempts to down any flying object, over our territory, in our airspace, then I think people will very much regret undertaking such an egregious violation of our territorial integrity and sovereignty.
Сергей, добрый день.
Good afternoon. If I may, two questions. The first question, German authorities have not concealed the fact that they have been engaged in active militarization of their country. What do you think? Why is this being done? And what are they trying to achieve? And the second question, you've already mentioned recently. You talked about privatization of virtually all of the leadership of the United Nations by the West. What could Russia do in order to change the situation? Thank you. On militarization of Germany, we repeatedly set out our concerns, our very deep concerns. And not only is there a process of militarization underway there, there are blatant indicators of re-Nazification, which are being observed. Why is this being done? Probably with the same aim that Hitler set for himself, to bring all of Europe under his control and to try to inflict a strategic defeat with Hitler, with the Soviet Union, and with the modern-day Germany and the rest of those, the chorus, the main soloists in the European Union and NATO. Now they're trying to inflict a defeat on Russia. Merz, I think it was yesterday, mentioned that we are not yet in a state of war, but we are no longer in a state of peace. The militaristic rhetoric is being ratcheted up with each passing day. And this statement was reiterated on a number of occasions now, that he pushed through amendments into the Constitution. Now it is possible to spend more funds on weaponry and development of military infrastructure, military capabilities. And he proudly stated, the chancellor, that his goal is to once again to make Germany the main military engine of Europe. And when a person in a country which perpetrated the crimes of Nazism, fascism, the Holocaust, genocide, when such a person says that Germany again needs to become a great military power, of course, he has an atrophied historical memory, and that is exceedingly dangerous.
So that's Sergei Lavrov there, warning about the re-Nazification of Germany, Martin.
Well, that's right, and of course, that's what's been going on. The Ukrainian right wing, who are the backbone of the regime in Kyiv, they trace their genealogy straight back to Stepan Bandera. There's tensions between the Ukrainian nationalists and the Poles because they killed 100,000 Poles in the Volyn massacres in the 1940s. All these people are dead in massive mass graves in what was around Lviv. Of course, back in the day it was Lvov. It was part of Poland. It had a big Polish and Jewish population. They were all wiped out by the Banderites in that era, and then it was made part of Ukraine. So the borders of Ukraine were decided by warfare, and they're not actually.
He does talk about these borders in that press. I think, and brilliant press conference. It's just a shame you won't talk in English, because so much easier for the translators to translate it into various other language from English rather than everything from Russian. And I'm also very disappointed in this Russian thing where they seem to be occasionally using AI now to do a translation into English, because they can't bear to employ English translators. But they've really got this wrong. As he's talking there about re-Nazification, I mean, I do like to pepper our second hour, particularly in with these investigative reports. And Mark Felton has, I think, done an excellent job in digging out more information about the death of Heinrich Himmler, who was the master, grandmaster, or whatever he was, chief of the SS during World War II. The Hitler's basically protection squad, worship squad, everyone that joined the SS had to swear an oath to Hitler himself personally. And what do you make about the death of Himmler? He was supposed to have taken a poison pill, apparently, in British custody.
I'm just trying to think about what I know about it. He's not the Goebbels, of course, took poison pills with his whole family in the bunker, didn't he? Himmler supposedly died by suicide. Is that what you're saying?
I love No, well, that's what he supposedly died by. But I love Mark Felton. He's been digging into loads of these stuff to do with the Nazis. He's done some excellent digging, although, of course, he hasn't got really to the bottom of it. He hasn't obviously read my book about Martin Bormann. And even has discovered, and if you haven't seen it, please go and watch it. It's a brilliant, I think it's about 10-minute investigation of Martin Bormann's private secretary and how she was given a lovely house in suburbia in the stockbroker belt and looked after very, very nicely after in World War II. And her neighbours had no idea she was basically the secretary to Hitler's treasurer and personal private secretary. So she was, just to clarify, Bormann was Hitler's secretary and she was his secretary. So, you know, this is the sort of thing Mark Felton does extremely well. And he's also dug out some quite serious, in fact, very serious anomalies in the British story about what happened with Himmler at the end of the Second World War, and at least an extra day that's unaccounted for.
In the world of aviation, Eric Brown was up there with Chuck Yeager and other flying legends. A Royal Navy pilot, Brown was a fighter pilot turned test pilot who officially flew an astounding 487 different types of aircraft, a Guinness World Record. He also held the world record for the largest number of carrier landings, 2,407, or more than 20 aircraft carriers during the war. He was awarded the Distinguished Service Cross for combat actions earlier in the war and made a member of the Order of the British Empire for his test pilot activities. Post-war, he was made an officer of the Order of the British Empire and later upped to commander, also being awarded the Air Force Cross and the King's Commendation for Valuable Service in the Air, and retired in 1970 with the rank of Naval Captain. Eric Brown died in 2016 at the age of 96. My programs generate a lot of emails from viewers, and some of them suggest new lines of inquiry or new evidence that I sometimes research further. How I came to this new information about Himmler was, like most things, quite by chance. I was emailed back in June concerning the death of Hermann Göring in 1946, and the story concerned Eric Brown, who of course spoke and wrote about his interviewing Göring as part of his duties in Germany at war's end, investigating high-tech Luftwaffe aircraft. Looking into the story, which is outside the remit of this program, but let's just say the sources indicated that there may have been more to Brown and Göring's meeting than officially admitted to, I looked up some online interviews made of Eric Brown before his death, and was stunned when he started discussing meeting not only Göring, but also Heinrich Himmler. Here is the segment of an interview conducted with Brown at the RAF Museum, Hendon, in London, some years before he died. I am indebted to the interviewer, Nicholas Jones, for kind permission to use this film, which is from Eric Brown, a pilot story available on DVD from its producer, Quanta Films. Check out the link in the description box.
What about Himmler?
Yes, I had a very short interrogation of Himmler just before he committed. And he was the absolute opposite of Göring. He really had not much to say for himself, and he always took refuge in the fact that he said he was acting entirely under orders from higher authority. I did ask him only one real question about aviation. I had heard that at one stage he had arrested, around about 1943, I think it was, he had arrested Werner von Braun, who was their top rocket man. So I asked him why this took place. And he said that he thought von Braun had lost interest in helping the war effort, but was devoting too much time to his visions of space travel. And this was the reason he withdrew him from, if you like, the rocket scene for a short time. I think it was only about 3 months.
Knowing as I do an awful lot about Himmler's last days, I had no recollection of any document or history book regarding this subject mentioning his being questioned by a certain Fleet Air Arm test pilot. When did this occur? I didn't have a copy of Brown's autobiography, but a quick check online revealed that my local library in Norwich certainly did have, so I hot-footed it down there and dug out the book from the stacks and began looking for references to Himmler. The only reference to the Reichsfuhrer SS is of Brown test-flying Himmler's personal Focke-Wulf FW-200 Condor plane. His autobiography contained absolutely no other references to Himmler. His meeting with Goering, whom he seemed to like very much, was of course included in the book. So what's going on? Perhaps someone like Brown, privy to classified material concerning German weapons and also British weapons, undoubtedly had to submit the manuscript of his autobiography to the Ministry of Defence to ensure that it didn't contravene any secrets, then still current, at the time of publication. But Brown definitely spoke about meeting and questioning Himmler, as you've seen in the interview clip. He did this towards the end of his long life, when he was very elderly, but still sharp mentally. Had Brown let something about Himmler out of the bag? Was he too old to care anymore whether his apparently innocuous talk with Himmler contravened any official secrets? And more importantly, why had no other historians noticed this admission, which had been in the public arena for years? Was Brown telling the truth? He certainly had an excellent reputation for doing so, and I see absolutely no reason to disbelieve him on any other subject. But his autobiography was very interesting in that, like so many of the reminiscences or private papers of people involved in the last days of Himmler's life, it has a gap during the period when Himmler was in British custody, which is suspicious when placed against what Brown was saying in public interviews. Himmler's demeanour is also completely different in Brown's version of the unmasking of Himmler. Instead of being chatty and friendly, sitting opposite Sylvester's desk, discussing a letter he had written to Field Marshal Montgomery, Brown's Himmler was afraid for his life and very concerned to save his own skin. It would suggest that the manner of the interrogation was harsh. I'm not suggesting he was beaten up, but I think the way this senior NCO came at him was designed to frighten the prisoner into fessing up, and probably had overtures or suggestions of imminent violence. Where exactly this interrogation occurred is not noted by Brown in the interview. So why was Brown saying these things late in life? He seemed to certainly have his marbles right up to the day he died. Perhaps the treatment of Himmler didn't sit well with him. Perhaps he was proud of having taken part in the interrogation of Himmler and wanted some of it on record.
I think it's most likely. Thanks very much, Mark Felton, for that investigation. I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. And he's basically discovered an entire day that Himmler was in custody, where presumably if he had a little file in his tooth that he could bite on cyanide and kill himself, he would have done it at some point. But anyway, they were obviously chit-chatting with the head of the SS for a while before he allegedly committed suicide, and he may not have done at all. He may have been murdered,
or he may have been taken to South America like Bormann, because that's what the British did with Bormann, isn't it?
They had a body and a burial, apparently. That was done fairly, I don't know if it was done publicly, but anyway, yeah. So he's been interrogated anyway. That fact is, they're lying.
Yes, I mean, what happened at the end of World War II, as you know from writing your books.
Trevor Roper wrote, I think it was like The Last Days of Hitler, didn't he? Which was supposed to be the official story. Only thing is, he was working for MI6, and he was being told, say this, say that, say this.
Yes, and obviously what happened at the end of World War II, as you know from the Red House meeting in Strasbourg after the Battle of Falaise Gap, is that elements within the Nazi leadership were already negotiating with the West about what would happen after the war, how they were going to all line up together and fight the Soviet Union.
And
that's
particularly
what Patton wanted to do.
Particularly, loads of them were rescued.
And
nuclear weapons, particularly, were being traded for safe passage.
Yes, all of these things are true. And of course, that explains very a lot about why we're in the mess we're in now. Because what happened at the end of World War II, because the Soviet Union then became the big enemy, is that the Western powers decided to integrate the Nazi intelligence structure into the creation of NATO. And it's pretty obvious in the sense that Reinhard Gehlen, who used to head up the Gestapo, ended up heading up the BND, which is the West German secret services, and lots of Hitler's generals ended up being heads of the Bundeswehr. Now, of course, in actual fact, the Russians have always known. I mean, Stepan Bandera died in Munich in 1959 because he was assassinated by the KGB, even though, of course, he was wanted in Russia for killing millions of people. The fact is that the Western powers have always had a Nazi strain within the secret services, and that's why they go in for all of this kind of false flag terrorism, manipulations of the population and so on. It's just a continuation of the Third Reich into the Fourth Reich.
Yeah, financial Fourth Reich. So Moldova, where is Moldova?
It's just, if you know where Romania is, Moldova is further east. Yeah, and it used to be part of Romania when it was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
You're getting closer and closer to Ukraine.
It's not quite. It doesn't quite lean on, because Transnistria, which is a Russian breakaway region of Moldova was part of the Soviet Union. So what happened at the end of World War II is the borders of the Ukraine were pushed westwards. Yeah. The borders that we're now talking about in Eastern Europe, like Poland's borders, for example, were decided by Stalin. Ukraine's borders were decided by Stalin.
So it's sandwiched in between Romania and Ukraine.
Yes, so in other words, it's mostly Romanian.
Landlocked.
Yeah, it's mostly Romanian-speaking, but it was put part of the Soviet Union, yeah? So the border of the Ukraine in the west was pushed westward. Yeah, so they took in Transcarpathia, which has got a Hungarian minority there, and you had a Romanian minority in Moldova. But they voted to leave the Soviet Union and become an independent country. When they did that, the Russian speakers in Transnistria, who are along the Dniester River there, they've been there since hundreds of years, they voted to leave Moldova. And of course, they've just had an election in Moldova, which the Western Sandu, the Western puppet, has won, but there's massive evidence of cheating. So, for example, the Transnistrians weren't, only a few thousand of them got to vote because they didn't provide them with any ballot papers.
Also, the pro-Russian parties had been banned.
That's
some
right.
of them actually just right. literally on the eve of the election
That's
date.
Right.
This wasn't really reported in the Western press at all. It was reported as, oh, isn't it wonderful? These people want to join the EU. They voted for pro-EU parties. This is sounding like another Ukraine.
Well, it is. The danger is, of course, the Transnistrians have got a Russian peacekeeping force there to prevent the Moldovan main central government from overrunning them. And, of course, many in Moldova would like to be part of Romania, but many of them are, in fact, Russian-speaking, and they don't want to be part... You know, there's a big split in Romania, in Moldova, between those who are pro-Western and those who are more pro-Russian, if you like. And, of course, there's another possibility for war here, is that the Ukrainians and the Moldovans, with the support of the West, could try and liquidate Transnistria. And, of course, Russians...
Let's just make it clear where we're talking about here, because as you head towards Kyiv... on the Black Sea shore there. First of all,
Kyiv is not on the Baltic shore.
No, as you head towards it from Romania, yeah. First of all, you've got a large country called Moldova, which has only just about got any kind of access to the Black Sea. In fact, I'm not sure it does have any.
It does have
It's very, very close.
It's very small. It's
a tiny little
Transnistria. Transnistria doesn't have access to the Black Sea.
Anyway, so yeah. Transnistria is a very thin country just to the east of Moldova. Before you get to Ukraine. So they are kind of sandwiched now, Transnistria, between Moldova and Ukraine.
That's right. And, of course, what you've got in Transnistria, Russian people settled there hundreds of years ago, and they live on both sides of that river, which is why the country is very long and thin, because they're people who live on both sides of the river. But they're Russian-speaking Russians. And when the Soviet Union collapsed, Moldova voted to break out of the Soviet Union and become an independent state. And Transnistria then voted to leave Moldova because they didn't want to be ruled by
the
Romanian
majority. We heard earlier
majority.
On in the show about the silly decision, the really idiotic decision of the so-called Troika, the French and the Germans and the British, to implement the snapback, that is to say the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action sanctions against Iran, who probably doesn't have a nuclear weapon, other than not to have sanctions on Israel, that definitely does have nuclear weapons. So this is how hypocritical it is. But also at that meeting this week, they also discussed Moldova too.
This is Moldova's president, Maia Sandu. She won an election largely marked by Russian interference, according to the EU. Sandu's win is widely seen here as a sign European ideals of democracy have healthy support and will prevail.
The EU is planning to spend more than $380 billion on its military forces this year. The Russian invasion of Ukraine has led to a rethink of European defense strategy, with the bloc saying that if it doesn't ramp up its military capabilities, Russia may be tempted to invade more territory in the future. Hashim Al-Bal, Al Jazeera, Copenhagen.
Right, so this is this Danish meeting. Moldova is just described there. I mean, at least Al Jazeera does say, well, this is according to the EU.
Yeah, I mean, what's happened there? I used to comment on what was going on in Moldova for RT when I used to do stuff for RT. Most people in the West are profoundly ignorant of all of the geography of Eastern Europe.
Well, that's why I'm trying to do a little bit of geography. So has it been pro-Russian up till now, Moldova?
There's been a bit of a struggle, as in the Ukraine. Yeah, some people want to be more pro-EU. Others are just saying, well, we don't want to get in. I mean, in Hungary, for example, the ruling Fidesz party, they do not want to have a war with Russia, nor do the people in Slovakia. Nor did the people in Romania. So the Romanian election was cancelled, and the guy who was likely to win was told he couldn't stand. All of this is pressure by the Western powers on the countries which are in the front line of the Ukraine war. They live next door to it, and they can see the danger of a war breaking out right where they are. And of course, the Ukrainians have been blowing up pipelines which take gas and oil from Russia to Slovakia and Hungary, which is vital to their economies. They do not want a war. They just want it finished. But of course, Britain, we're 1,000 miles away. We're all mad keen for a war with Russia because it's 1,000 miles away. It's not going to affect us. So that's why we're so keen on it. And of course, the Americans are even more thousands of miles away. So they really don't care.
Anyway, well, as Moldova has been banning all these pro-Russian parties over there, several politicians have had to go abroad. One of them is Marina Tauba. She's a former politician over in Moldova, pro-Russian. And she was on RT this week. You know, that channel we're not allowed to see.
Well, let's discuss developments live now with exiled Moldovan MP Marina Tauber, former first vice chair of the SOR party, which was banned in her nation. You're most welcome. Thank you for your time today.
Hi, thank you very much for the invitation.
How would you describe this vote?
That was the most dirty campaign in the history of Moldova. I would say that there are no words to describe what has happened yesterday and before the election day. For sure, as it was already stated by Mr. Ilan Shor, our leader, we don't recognize these elections. And the new elections should be organized, because all the results that you were mentioning and that the people do see after yesterday's elections, they are not real. They are drawn. So this is not the will of the people.
Your SOR party was banned by Moldova's constitutional court and was therefore unable to take part in this latest election. Do you believe PAS would have got a parliamentary majority if people were allowed to vote for you?
For sure, no. And I would like to mention once again that they do not have any majority. The results are drawn. This is something that they have invented. And that's why yesterday all of us have seen that the website of the Central Electoral Commission was not working all the time. And that is why they needed so much time until morning in order to announce the official results, because they were working on them.
It appears
and they
people,
actually are
yeah, go ahead.
Not actually they're not really publishing everything, because they understand that if it will be compared with the official documents, it will be clear that there are no votes for the results that they have announced.
Which is hugely significant as well. Just as you're speaking, we were looking at pictures of people amassing in Chisinau, coming out to protest the result. Do you think, will it make a difference? Will authorities listen to that outpouring of opposition?
Look, these authorities are not going to listen to anyone. They are listening only to their European bosses, and they don't care at all about the interests of Moldovans and what they are talking about and what they need. So what we can do is to win the next elections and just to start the new story of Moldova. Because these people that are in power already for nearly 6 years, they already have demonstrated to everyone that they are not the government of Moldova. First of all, many of them are citizens of the other countries, such as Romania, for instance. And all of them, they are listening, as I have already said, to European coordinators. And they're not only listening, they're doing what they say. So there is no chance for something in our country with this government, with Maia Sandu and PAS. They should leave, and this is the only way for the development and for the future of our country.
So that's Russia Today, which we're not allowed to see in Britain. The naughty Moscow broadcasters talking in English to the rest of the world, but not to Britain, explaining that actually the country has basically been carved up and the election's fixed.
That's right. And of course, the West goes on about how the Russians are fixing elections, blah, blah, blah. And yet, in fact, it's them that does exactly that. It's a projection.
So it's not just the Israelis where an accusation is a confession. It's actually us too. We're saying the Russians are fixing the, trying to fix the Moldovan elections, but thankfully they weren't. Actually, we have fixed them and we've put our little puppet in charge now.
Yes, and the danger, of course, as that lady will be aware, is that Moldova could become the next battlefield. And, of course, that's what people don't want. That's what people in Romania don't want. That's what people in Slovakia don't want. That's what people in Hungary don't want. All of these countries which are nearest to the conflict want to be neutral and they want it over with. But countries like Britain, where, frankly, the ordinary politician in this country couldn't find any of these places on the map and doesn't know where they are, we want war with Russia because we're not there. And we don't really understand what war means. People in these parts of the world, they do. We don't.
So we expect to see Moldova dragged into this war with Russia,
yes,
with loads of young Moldovan lads being given a gun and told go and kill Russians?
What will happen is potentially the Moldovan army, with the backing of NATO, will try and overtake Transnistria, which has got a Russian kind of trigger force in there. It's only a few thousand people. And then the Russians will have to come in to protect their own people, and then we're off. And, of course, the really shocking thing is that Britain and the European Union powers seem to want to have a full-on war with Russia. It's a war they cannot possibly win. The war's been, as we know, the war's been raging now since 2022, and in actual fact since 2014, and there is no way that modern warfare, that the West can compete with Russia in its backyard.
Anyway,
we will simply be smashed.
On RT this week, I mean, it's such a shame we can't get it on the satellite preview, etc. It is there on Rumble still. Brazil and various other platforms. If you've got a VPN, you can watch it, or a Tor browser. There are other ways to get through to, but you have to work quite hard to watch RT nowadays. Another interesting item on there was this former British Defence Minister, or Defence Secretary, I think he was, wasn't he? Ben Wallace, saying that he wants to make Crimea uninhabitable. So rather than sort of try and liberate the people of Crimea, which is what they keep talking about, they're now much content to maybe nuke it or something.
Well, what has been happening is that HIMARS and the British missiles, the names I've forgotten now, the HIMARS are the American ones. What are our ones called? I've forgotten them.
The Storm Shadows.
Storm Shadows, yeah. One of our missiles was used to hit a beach in Crimea last week and killed several
Storm Shadows with a umlaut. Storm.
Yes, well, that's right. So we hit a beach and killed several civilians on the beach, including several children. Because, of course, the policy of the Ukrainians now is they're losing on the battlefield.
I mean, we killed more people on the beach, more kids, than were killed yesterday in the synagogue in Manchester.
Absolutely. And we are directly responsible, as the Russians well know. And
it was I haven't heard a big hoo-ha about that.
No, that's right, because it's a prop.
It's we're doing the killing.
Yes. Now, people go on about we live in this country in a bubble. Why do you think they banned RT? And as you know, Tony, I used to be on RT for 8 years. Why have they banned it? It's because they can't compete with genuine investigations into what's going on. They just can't compete with it, because therefore what they've done is they just made it go away. You don't need to know what they're saying, because we will tell you.
The truth has some amazing kind of resonance in people's minds, and when they hear the truth, they know it, and so they can't be allowed. I mean, this whole thing about the way the mass media works is it's all about what they don't tell you.
That's right. So and of course, a lot of it isn't even news. So Strictly Come Dancing takes up an awful lot of people's time before we even get to the news, and then the news itself is a farrago of nonsense.
So what about Ben Wallace, this wonderful British defence attack war guy, saying that it should be uninhabitable, Crimea, this place that we're supposed to think is, it has been taken by the Russians, and we want to help the people there to get liberated. But no, we want to make it uninhabitable now.
Well, that's because the policy has always been just to wreck and destroy the potential of the Russian Federation. That's the whole point of it.
Anyway, let's have a listen to...
They're just going for, whatever they can do now to smash Russia up.
Let's have a listen to RT discussing this, which we're not allowed to hear. Naughty little boys. Oh, no, you can't watch RT.
Well, let's get some deeper analysis now with political strategist and nuclear energy specialist Renat Karcha, advisor to the head of the Republic of Crimea. You're most welcome. Thank you for your time today, sir. How have Crimean authorities reacted to the call by the former British Defence Minister to make the peninsula, quote, uninhabitable?
You know,
usually diseased people, including mentally diseased people, are treated with, pity. But in this case, though, since this disease is obviously special, a disease that's called fascism, there can only be one response. Response of contempt and revulsion. Any other response to such words, to such statements, to such sort of ideology, there can be none.
Such calls are not new for Crimea. Decades ago, Kiev-backed nationalists declared that the peninsula should become Ukrainian or uninhabited. Do you see a connection, given the same term was used this time?
There's, a coincidence in one thing. They basically have the same, what I call, confession of the former defense secretary of Ukraine, of Great Britain, and Ukrainian nationalists. What they have in common is fascism, pure and simple. The fact of the matter is, if we draw parallels between his statements regarding Crimea and the situation around the Zaporozhye nuclear power plant starting summer 2022, I was often asked, what my forecasts would be if anything happens. Well, my favorite response was any predictions regarding the behavior of mentally ill people are the prerogative of psychiatrists, because those people, Great Britain, they essentially scripted the whole set of activities related to fire strikes against the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant and all the infrastructure in direct vicinity of it. You simply cannot fathom just how unhinged they were, especially in the summer of 2022, delivering direct strikes against the infrastructure of the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant and objects within its perimeter. The goal of those people, even back then, they aimed for a nuclear incident, or better still, for a nuclear disaster. Better in their understanding, I mean. So to me, statements like that, statements made by the ex-Secretary of Defense, are nothing new. It's just a continuation of the ideology and approaches and technologies used by the collective West against Russia. Since the very outset, we said that those people are not interested in Ukraine as such. Ukrainians are cannon fodder for them. They aim for Russia. They are after Russia. They aim to deliver strategic defeat to Russia. And Ukraine simply acts as a vehicle here. And Ukrainian people are expendables.
So that's spokesman for Crimea there, reacting to this idea that the British want to make his country uninhabitable.
Yes, and of course the main issue in 2014 was that the Sevastopol naval base, which was because Crimea was only put into Ukraine in 1954. Before that, it was part of the Russian Federation. So, you know, because it was Khrushchev decided, because he was Ukrainian.
This is before the days of the Russian Federation, isn't
yes,
it? This is part of Russia.
Yes,
know.
I know. We're talking about internal, redrawing internal boundaries, like local government reorganization here in this country. Okay? The majority of the population in Crimea in recent times has been overwhelmingly Russian. And they don't want to, they never wanted to be part of the Ukraine. In fact, they had several referendums after the 1990s to try and get out of the Ukraine. But each time, the Russian Federation, you know, led by Yeltsin and then by Putin, was saying, well, no, look, we'll just have to work with what we've got here. Let's not try and upset the apple cart because it could cause all kinds of problems. But ultimately, of course, when in 2014 there was a coup in, Kiev, as it then was, against the democratically elected Yanukovych government, incidentally involving a massacre of pro-EU demonstrators and police officers, which we know to have been carried out by a NATO death squad run by a US officer called Christopher Boyenga. Coming back to our earlier discussion about NATO killing people, they do kill people. They've killed lots of people. They've killed people in the Ukraine. Yeah. And it's not the Ukrainians doing that. That's us.
Okay, so Ben Wallace's actual quote was, "We must help Ukraine acquire long-range capabilities to make Crimea uninhabitable. We need to strangle Crimea." Now, this is why? Why would you want to do that? I mean, we had the Crimean War, didn't we, in the 1800s. What is it the British hate so much about Crimea?
In the 1850s, we invaded Crimea, if you remember, with the French and the Turks. And we actually won the war. We captured Sevastopol. We gave it back to them. And of course, most people think, oh, that was a different era. But was it the Russians invading Cornwall? No. It was us invading Russia. When the French army, the Grand Army, marched on Moscow in 1812, was it the Russians invading, or were they being
this
invaded?
This is Napoleon.
Yes, and then when the Germans invaded the Soviet Union,
Barbarossa, 1941.
Who was invading who? The Russians, in fact, have only ever reacted defensively to protect their interests. They're not that interested in conquering Western Europe.
The Russians actually don't like it when people say we're going to render some part of Russia uninhabitable. They've responded today. A map shows a UK infrastructure site's military, in brackets, they haven't put that in the headline here though, in the Metro, that a Russian senator has called to bomb in Britain. Senior Russian official has shared dozens of British defence sites on television before suggesting Vladimir Putin could target them in missile strikes. Dmitry Rogozin, a senator and war combatant, threatened that the UK could become dangerous and urged Russians not to send their children to the country to school. It comes as he and Putin's mouthpiece, which is what this is calling him, Vladimir Solovyov, both slammed former British Defence Secretary Ben Wallace after he called out Russia for saying that he should make Crimea uninhabitable and unviable. A map highlights UK defence sites as targets. He added former British Defence Minister Ben Wallace and what he should do to end exactly. We must help Ukraine to acquire long-range capabilities, as I said. And my advice to our oligarchs, do not send your children to study in England. It's a deadly dangerous place. The map he's shared here, it's actually a British defence map, and it's got dots all over the place, about four in Wales. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And I'll share this on our show page if you're interested. In southern England. And then about maybe 15 in the Midlands and the North. But probably the safest place to hide from Russians is Anglesey or Norfolk, or possibly the Lake District.
Well, these are British military bases, like Credon Hill, where the
23 defence sites.
That's right. So if British missiles are used to render Crimea uninhabitable, then they're not going to kill loads of British people, civilians, but they are going to use their hypersonic weaponry to destroy British military infrastructure. So if we go to war with Russia, as Ben seems to be suggesting, the first thing that will happen is, if I was the Russian military...
But Ben will say, no, Crimea is not Russia. You have annexed it, Mr. Putin.
Okay, well, let's just talk about the military possibilities here. What the Russians could do is say, if you start doing things like that, we're going to start picking off your military bases. But what I would advise to the Russian general staff is if they start doing that, whack all of their military bases straight away, kill thousands and thousands of British military personnel in their bases, because, of course, they're not spread out as they should be if they want to avoid being killed like that. And then, of course, the British have got no answer to that. They could fire nuclear weapons at Russia, but then Britain will be nuked. Otherwise, there's nothing they can do because we haven't got any hypersonic missiles. The Iranians and the Russians and the Chinese, they're the only people
from
with
what
hypersonic
you're saying,
missiles.
From, from what you're saying, the Russians don't sound like a paper tiger to me.
No, the Russian minister said, we're not a paper tiger, we are a real bear.
Right. Also this week I had a chat to Andy Gordon from New Zealand, because a few weeks ago, and I think didn't you say, Martin, that there is another march in Bristol here and some other parts of the country maybe at the weekend by Tommy Robinson and his crew? Well, just give us a complete, like, from the bottom, from the top, from the bottom, wherever, the point of Tommy Robinson and his operations, because he clearly is linked to the Israelis. He's clearly megally Islamophobic. The idea is to try and get everyone to hate Muslims by whatever means. In fact, he proved that the other week when he stopped people speaking who weren't weren't pro-Israel enough.
Well, that's right. He's got, there's pictures of him in the Golan Heights prancing around with a Galil submachine gun and his hand on top of a tank. And he's been given plenty of money. And of course, the Israelis are pushing, the Israeli right wing are very much aligned with the right wing in this country and other European countries on the anti-Islam, agenda. And of course, that then fits in with the whole thing that we've been saying about how NATO created the Islamist insurgencies, which they then say, oh, we've got to go and invade these countries to put a stop to it, but we're the ones behind it. Now, it's not just crazy people like me and you saying these things. The Russian general staff and the secret services, they know exactly what's going on here. They know exactly what's going on. And if it comes to a war, we will simply lose. And it doesn't matter who the Prime Minister was, whether it was Keir Starmer, Nigel Farage, whoever it was, we're simply going to lose, and that's all there will be to it. And of course, that's when you do get revolutions. That's what caused the Russian Revolution in 1905 and the Russian Revolutions of 1917, was loss in warfare, defeat. That's when you get revolution.
Okay, before we hear from Andy in Dunedin, let's have a listen to the New Zealand Foreign Minister speaking at the United Nations.
Now, we noted the announcements by some countries in July and August that they intended to recognise Palestinian statehood this week, now confirmed. We have also closely observed the Israeli government's actions in Gaza and on the West Bank following these earlier announcements. And we have listened carefully to the arguments made earlier this week at the Two-State Solution Conference. Palestinian statehood recognition is, however, uniquely complicated given it is embedded in a seemingly intractable, never-ending conflict situation. Very few New Zealanders can recall any period of sustainable peace in the Middle East during their lifetimes. And while New Zealand is furthest away from that conflict in the Middle East, we also acknowledge the strongly held views people have about it. New Zealanders were appalled by the barbarity of Hamas attack on Israel citizens on October 7, 2023. The worst massacre in Israel's history, and Hamas have no plan and no place in any future Palestinian state. They know only hate. Today, nearly 2 years on from the horror inflicted that day, including the continued holding of Israeli hostages by Hamas, we are shocked to our core by harrowing images of famine in Gaza. We are also revolted by what can only be described as a grossly disproportionate response from the Israeli government. However, there is an old saying about a musical instrument that sums up well the vexed question of Palestinian statehood recognition. If the string is too tight, it will snap. But if it is too loose, the instrument will not play. Those countries who hope their earlier signaling of Palestinian statehood recognition would protect and promote the two-state solution have instead seen the Israeli government snap and continue its widely condemned military actions in Gaza while continuing to develop illegal settlements on the West Bank in defiance of international law.
So that's the Foreign Minister of New Zealand. He sounds to me like he's just reading a script. He's not a great speaker. Also sounds a bit like an American puppet now, doesn't he?
Well, that's right, because, of course, the recognition of a Palestinian state, I mean, in many ways, it's a bit of a farce, because it's just a symbolic something or other, because it doesn't mean anything. The Palestinian people are being liquidated as we speak, so recognising their state, and, of course, they're only recognising the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, who lost the election of 2006. Mahmoud Abbas did not win the election. He lost it. But that's what they're talking about. But the New Zealand, right-wing New Zealand government are absolutely in the pocket of the Israelis and the Americans. So although Australia, Canada, Britain and France have all recognised a Palestinian state, they're with the Americans and the Israelis, they're against it.
Well, various of my contacts over in New Zealand are saying that they seem to be weaponising the Maori people. One of those obvious examples is this Maori group that were brought over to the UK to dance at the Tommy Robinson. And the idea is to give loads of extra power to certain specific Maoris in order to start some kind of race war, if you can believe that, over in New Zealand. But certainly people over there are concerned. But anyway, this is a clip from an interview I did with Andy Gordon over in Dunedin, who's our sort of, I suppose, he's our Asia correspondent. Is it Southeast Asia correspondent, I guess, isn't he? He does a super job, actually. And very many, in fact, I'm not sure if it's even in this clip I'm about to play, but he talks about how it was that the Americans tried to trick the New Zealand government into bringing a nuclear capable warship into their waters, and that Nicky Hager, who's an investigative journalist, when he was a young man in his teens, or around about 20 years old, informed the Prime Minister, yes, this ship could be nuclear, it could have nuclear weapons on board. And so because the Prime Minister had got this information, the Deputy Prime Minister, the ship was turned away. Anyway, as usual, terrific tales from Andy in New Zealand.
I mean, you know, it's very interesting because, like you said, he was at that protest. And, you know, when I saw that, I thought, well, you know, what's he doing there? And then I had a sort of moment of clarity where the next moment on the big screen is sort of Elon Musk's face. And it kind of all made sense because I think that MAGA movement, you know, Elon Musk and others are trying to make that a worldwide movement, you know, with Tommy Robinson. And here in New Zealand, definitely, I think, with that Brian Tamaki and his Destiny Church, I mean, the money they've got is actually unbelievable, you know, and they're running protests in Auckland and Wellington, and they will get 20,000-odd people there. And what they're protesting against is the same things as what Tony Robinson's, you know, protesting against is immigration. Is one of the big ones, which New Zealand, it seems very strange because New Zealand doesn't really have a problem with immigration, you know, and like in America, obviously there's a big immigration thing with the MAGA movement. So, and that's going on around Europe, you know. I think Elon Musk has been proved that he's got a right-wing government that he's sort of put in place in some of the South American countries now. Argentina's one. And I think across Europe, you know, you've got Austria and Italy, and, you know, I think there is a sort of worldwide sort of movement there. Brian Tamaki, you know, the reason I say he's well-funded, he'll turn up at these protests with all his Maori crew. They've all got brand new Harley Davidsons. He might be in a Aston Martin, you know, or a Ferrari, you know, and he's definitely got some money. And how much does it cost to fly from New Zealand, 20 Maoris to London, put them up in a hotel? You know, you're talking about $50,000, I'd say, to sort of fund that. So there's definitely money there. And it's a very strange church. I mean, you know, he's evangelical, sort of Christian Zionist sort of church, and they all dress in black. You know, he preaches in black. He wears like black jeans, black shirt, you know, a bit like Elon Musk himself. And
well, it's interesting you mention this, you know, wearing black. I see this all the time. There is this idea of a sort of in joke within the media. Ah, right, yes, he's one of us, you know, because they've got their black shirt on, their black T-shirt. Now, I'm not saying everyone that wears black on television is or gets photographed wearing black is in some little cult or whatever, but this is certainly something I've heard. I remember overhearing this sort of thing within the journalist union and actually in broadcasting. A sort of little, it's like they wink at each other, yeah, I'm in black again today, you know. So this is something that the public probably don't have no idea of, but there is this is out there. Wearing black is a way of signalling your treachery, really, towards the viewers and the listeners and obviously to the congregation who are coming along to the church.
Yeah, well, you know, there is such a thing as people believe in this sort of colour therapy, don't they? And the colours you wear attract certain energies and so on. And, you know, normally church, you normally go for a white or light colours, red or so on. But black is more a colour of, you know, witches and so on, aren't they? You know, and vampires. So... yeah, it's very strange.
Yeah, it's the colour of night. Yeah, this is the old idea, is we like to do things in the dark, in the darkness. This is how we think this is cool. Anyway, I just wonder if there's anything you wanted to add about national or international politics in New Zealand. Obviously, you're in a bit of the shadow of both America and China there, aren't you?
Yeah, well, we had an interesting incident, actually, probably 2 months ago, where the new FBI director Patel came to New Zealand to open an FBI office in Wellington, you know, and this is what I mean when, you know, the states have got their claws into New Zealand, because I mean, I can't see what reason you'd need an FBI office in New Zealand for.
Well, let's just clarify, the FBI is the United States' domestic intelligence service, a bit like Britain's MI5.
Yeah. And
so they shouldn't be there. They shouldn't be operating abroad.
No.
I mean, you know, obviously you can have a foreign intelligence service, the Central Intelligence Agency.
Yeah.
That would be kind of normal to have their desk within the US embassy in Wellington, but certainly not the FBI. What are they? It's like having MI5 in Moscow. I mean, they don't even, they're not even allowed to operate abroad.
That's right, yeah. And in his speech, Patel said, you know, they are there to counter China's influence in the South Pacific. You know, and I've spoken before to you about how America would love to get a war going on between China and Australia, New Zealand, or whoever, you know, in the Pacific here. And I think that upset a few New Zealanders, and all the top brass were there, the top police commissioners, the intelligence services of New Zealand were there. And another funny thing that did make the news was he presented them all these top cops and intelligence people, he presented them with a 3D printed gun, handgun, which afterwards it came out was completely illegal, this type of gun in New Zealand, unless you had a special license. So how he brought those over to New Zealand is sort of beyond, you know, they're meant to be security agencies or whatever, and they've let this guy in with half a dozen guns. You
well,
know?
It may be a diplomatic bag or something, but then of course, you know, that's a bit naughty, him smuggling illegal stuff in through there. Anyway, it's funny that he obviously didn't know. The guy's obviously a little bit dim, or he's badly advised that he's getting this stuff out in public that's actually against the law in New Zealand. Well, well done for New Zealanders for pointing that out.
Yeah, no, good on the police, because they were the ones that came out and said, you know, we're going to have to destroy those weapons. And obviously some journalists picked up on that, and it made a few headlines, which is quite funny. But the thing about these comments about China, you know, that just shows the sort of direction that America wants to take New Zealand, I think. And, you know, New Zealand's being punished ever since the incident with the warship that was denied, the American warship that was denied harbour in New Zealand back in the 80s. You know, since then, New Zealand's one of the only countries, definitely in the Five Eyes partnership and Western countries, that do not have a free trade agreement to this day with America.
So there's Andy Gordon there. He goes on to talk about Nikki Haga's role in stopping that American warship docking, and the Americans obviously were rather annoyed by that. But all sorts of, I mean, amazing that the printed guns then have to be destroyed. But in a way, it's, I mean, I love Andy's insight here, because it seems quite obvious that the evil empire is doing everything it can to start wars with China, Russia, or whoever, and they don't care if New Zealand or Australia are used as a proxy to start war with China, do they, the Americans?
No, because previously, of course, the Americans, being as they are, you know, in the, you know, with the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans protecting them from any real danger, that's why they're so belligerent and full of themselves. But of course, it's quite feasible now. The Russian hypersonic weaponry can strike right into the center of the United States. If there is a war, then the United States itself, just like Britain, the Russians can strike Great Britain, and we can't strike back. The Iranians can strike Akrotiri Air Base in Cyprus, which is British sovereign territory. We can't strike back. And of course, if it comes to a war between Russia and the United States, bases inside the United States will be struck by Russian missiles, and the Americans won't be able to strike back unless they get out nuclear weapons and kill us all. So that's how dangerous the situation is.
Okay, well, our final item tonight is about the David Miliband speech at the Labour Party conference. I was just absolutely flabbergasted.
Ed Miliband.
Sorry, Ed Miliband's speech, yeah. who's the Energy and Climate Change Secretary. Very difficult line he's treading there, saying that we're going to get rid of gas and oil, but we're not going to lose any jobs. I suppose he's also kind of bigging up the idea that the nuclear power stations are going to give jobs. But the thing that fascinated me was the way the BBC dealt with it later in the day. I think it was on the PM programme at 5. They brought Caroline Lucas on, who amazingly tried to justify the idea that, oh, you can shut down these industries in Britain and then just import stuff. Now, I remember this with the miners' strike. You know, they were saying, oh, no, the coal is really cheap, we can just import it. Really, they seem to be trying to entirely shut down these industries to help the nuclear industry, Martin.
Well, as you know, there's a massive debate about climate change, whether it's real, whether it's not real, what we need to do to get rid of it or not get rid of it.
But there's surely no argument. There we are. There's no argument if you're going to continue to use oil and gas to shut down your own supply of it. Why would you then want to become reliant on imports? Anyway, let's have a listen to Caroline Lucas and hear what she had to say on the PM programme from the Green Party, trying to justify this insane policy of shut down this stuff and just import it.
Well, it's clearly a massive debate. Listening to that is Caroline Lucas, who you will know was for many years leader of the Greens and indeed the first Green MP in Westminster. Caroline, nice to talk to you again. It seems that there is a bit of a journey being made by the government on this at the moment. What do you make of that?
Well, it feels like there is a monumental battle going on between Ed Miliband and Rachel Reeves, is how I would read it. I'm quite sure Ed Miliband would not want to see more new oil and gas licences being given in the North Sea, but I'm equally sure that Rachel Reeves does want to see that. But I think it's important to challenge the way she's framing it, because you'll remember she said she wanted to exploit UK resources on our own North Sea rather than importing it. And I don't know how many times we have to say this, but when it comes to oil, it is sold on global markets at international prices. So just because it's extracted from domestic waters doesn't mean that it belongs to us, that it automatically goes to us. These are global companies who will sell to the highest bidder.
So this is exactly the argument which was used back in the 1980s, saying we can shut down our coal mines and just import the stuff.
Or we're going to move away from using coal altogether. That's what's been said subsequently. And, of course, a lot of the coal we use comes from Colombia.
Anyway, I'll put the full version of that up, because it's quite an interesting whole piece that the BBC do, trying to justify this thing. And they say rather weaselly at the end, oh, well, there are other points of view, and maybe we'll talk about them with Reform UK or somebody else at some other time. But they're not actually even interested in the argument that actually we need oil and gas in order to keep going. Think of all those cars out there going round and round and round, folks. But the Greens just want to close down all of the oil and gas in Britain.
Well, can I just point out, it's outside Overton window, Tony.
Whilst they're also closing refineries down.
The blowing up of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which means that we can't, it means that the whole of the European...
Well, that's good, is it? The Greens like that, because they don't like gas.
Well, incidentally, that explosion created a massive methane leak, one of the biggest ever. Yeah. And nobody's allowed to talk about it, because it's an act of war by the United States on this country. And maybe what we need to do...
It was on Denmark, surely. It was in the Baltic.
Yes, because what do you think the effect was on our energy prices here in this country? Because as she points out, all of this energy is sold in spot markets.
It certainly helped all over Europe to jack up the energy prices. These big energy conglomerates are making an absolute fortune.
And energy is very, very important.
I hope you've got some shares in these energy companies, because if you've got around about £10,000 worth of shares, you never have to pay a bill anymore. Well, you're getting a nice return on that, but you never pay a bill.
We're a long way away from solar-powered tanks, and tanks need diesel.
Anyway, finally, let's have a listen to this piece I found on the digital ID. This is Jimmy Dore. I rather like Jimmy Dore. He seems to be a fairly sensible guy. And it's our final piece tonight. So maybe, Martin, you, after we've heard from Jimmy, can tell us whether you think Starmer's digital ID is the mark of the beast.
This government will make a new free-of-charge digital ID mandatory for the right to work by the end of this parliament. Let me spell that out. You will not be able to work in the United Kingdom if you do not have digital ID. It's as simple as that.
Conspiracy theorists proven correct again. Keir Starmer is mandating a digital ID. And watch the BS reason he gives you. It's good for you. It's always good for you, just like the vaccine. It's always good for you.
And that is why today I am announcing this government will make a new free of charge digital ID mandatory for the right to work.
Free of charge, Kurt. Free of charge. Oh. How royal of you. Well, yeah. You know the old saying, if at first you don't succeed, just lock the entire country down and take away everyone's rights.
Yeah.
So they're making it mandatory.
By the end of this parliament. Let me spell that out. You will not be able to work in the United Kingdom if you do not have digital ID. It's as simple as that.
So they're doing that. Why would you do it like that? You won't be able
to.
Let me
spell it out, Jimmy. No one can trade or buy or sell without the mark of the beast.
That's right.
He literally just said that in a different way.
You won't be able to access electricity. You won't be able to buy gas. You won't be able to do anything. You won't be able to get in your bank account. You won't be able to do anything unless you have the mark of the beast, which is the digital ID.
Unreal.
And he said you won't be able to work. So they say you won't be able to work because it looks like he's fighting illegal immigration.
Mm-hmm. I didn't get that.
Pretty sure that's not the people. So here we go. Let's watch this. Jeremy Corbyn and Nigel Farage. So far left and far right both agree on this. It's a bad idea. Jeremy Corbyn says, I firmly oppose the government's plans for compulsory digital ID cards. This is an affront to our civil liberties and will make the lives of minorities even more difficult and dangerous. It is excessive state interference and must be resisted. Must be resisted. Here's the far right guy, Nigel Farage, says, I am firmly opposed to Keir Starmer's digital ID cards. It will make no difference to illegal immigration, but it will be used to control and penalize the rest of us. The state should never have this much power. You know who else agrees with those two guys?
The king? I'm kidding. Obviously not.
And you know something is good for you when it's forced on you. That's how you know it's good for you. When it's forced on you. Just like the vaccine.
That's why, yeah.
Just like the vaccine and lockdowns and masks and social distancing, when it's forced on you.
So, Martin, being a bit of a beastie chap yourself, aren't you going to be looking forward to having this little ID, digital ID? And do you think it'll ever happen?
It strikes me that it's not going to happen because the opposition from both left and right is overwhelming. So, and of course, we're going to have a war where loads of people are going to be killed and we're not going to be
running
about
ideas. In a wartime, you've got to have an ID card because the secret police can come up to you and say, we want to see your papers.
Yes, well, that's, and you also need diesel to make your tanks run and all the rest of it.
Yeah, well, you can't do that if you haven't got a refinery. This is Patrizia's poem for this week, 4 feet, same boot. Kemi, a left beta, each point watch her blag. AI for answers, watch Smarma sag. Performance perfected, puppets on a stage, ignoring the public in poverty, enraged. Punch-ups, then lunch-ups, nothing in between. Questions and answers agreed behind the scenes. Full to the rafters for PMQ's show, but on genocide in Gaza, to the House of Commons they won't go. Farage, a barrage of race points, watch him score, while Smarma, no charmer, is destroying the law. Point scoring so boring, there's nothing to choose between imperialist parasites who live off the public and use. Divide us, deride us, vile puppets, no truth. Morally bankrupt with our lives, fast and loose. Lovely, thank you, Patrizia. It's time to sign off now. It's a war on God, but God's going to win. Thanks to our guests, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and also, of course, to Andy Gordon, Madda London, her tale about Tom Palmer. If you get the time in the meantime, have a look at that. It's an amazing story from about a decade ago, the guy that had a campaign against MI5 that suddenly dropped dead. We'll be hearing about that next week. And also, of course, to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Please download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like, and follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send me interviews and story tips on the Tony Gosling Censored Telegram channel and via the Not the BCFM Politics Show page, which includes the podcast, full-length interviews, the story links and a comment page. So subscribe to my free weekly newsletter, which may be going to your spam folder, but it's got loads of interesting stuff as well as often. So, for example, last week we had the full report from Dr. Chris Busby, his... the PDF of his report into possible use of a neutron weapon to kill Nasrallah. That was just sent out along with that, so you can have a good old look at it, as some people did. And if you can afford to, please donate or even set up a small monthly subscription. Thanks to all that already do at thisweekoneword.org.uk. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the talkradio.org.uk stream. Do please feel free to make live recordings. We've been streaming from Bristol at DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and also live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, which looks like it will be being updated soon. Get that from GitHub and from the show page. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing, enjoyable weekend, and do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless, and don't let the synagogue of satanic banksters get you down.
Looking, learning, moving on. Keep feeling fascinated. gets colder day by day. I miss you. The children will sing. He'll be back at Christmas time. In these frozen and silent nights, sometimes in a dream, you appear outside under the purple sky. Diamonds in the snow sparkle. Our hearts were singing. It felt like Christmas time. Two thousand miles is very far. Through the snow, I'll think of you wherever you go. It's colder.